You're from Texas? You like that country music? Here you go. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. That make you feel any better?
I feel like crap.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
It's not hot.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Kenny Rogers passed away this week at 81, and that was one of the more memorable closes to a Monday Night Raw in history, just before the final battle between Team WWF, the Alliance, at Survivor Series 2001, the go-home show, Stone Cold and The Rock, singing the hits, and The Rock going with The Gambler by Kenny Rogers. Also makes me think of the Kenny Rogers Roasters episode of Seinfeld. We broke 56,000 subscribers on YouTube this week, so thank you to all of you for making that happen. And all of our new subscribers, welcome. Hopefully they're listening here to the full podcast this week. This full podcast is episode 644 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, March 22nd, 2020. I am the Solid Monster. Keep supporting our sponsors, which always help the podcast out. Audible, of course, still a great partner to the show, and I know a lot of people are going to have a lot of free time on their hands. A lot of people are going to be a little isolated in their homes, maybe not know what to do outside of listening to podcasts. And listening to audiobooks is certainly one way to kill the time. You can get one free book when you sign up for a trial using our link. 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/Solomonster. You can cash in on your one free audiobook. Pick the wrestling or non-wrestling book of your choice. And some of these audiobooks, you know, are recited or narrated by the authors themselves. And it could be 6 hours, 8 hours, 9 hours, 10 hours of narration. So, in their own voice. So it's a good way to kill some time. And if you want to become a PayPal VIP, as so many people did this week, more people than I even expected, which is awesome, you can go to thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out here. All of our great VIPs who support the show each and every week, like the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, who wants to send a shout out to Second Shift Stocking at O'Reilly Auto Parts DC 36. Last week was his final one with them, as he is moving over to Quality Assurance, so he wanted to send that little shout out. Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot, Keith Hart, Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog. Always remember that in a zombie apocalypse. Aim for the Head. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman, Halistick, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Five Tool Player, Adam Bartolo, Project Zero Mortals, Wayne Ishanti, Handsome Harold White, Josh the Shooter Stockton, Nitrous Oxide, Nathan Kania, who says, listening to your show definitely helps getting through working a day in Walmart during this pandemic. Yeah, I can't imagine, you know, the people that work in a place like Walmart or in a grocery store right now, they got to be just stressed to the max. And what do you do? What do you do to de-stress? You know, I guess you listen to podcasts, I guess. DeVenom Johnny Roo, Ali X Kokar, the Rabbit King Christian Dye, the Can't Miss Prospect, Josh Kaysen, a first-time donator, and Dark Soul, Jeff Cole, also a first-time donator. Jesse Too Bad Tiarina, who wants to congratulate his friend John Too Dope Contreras on his engagement and just finding out that he has a bride-to-be who is now pregnant. Jesse and John both have been listening to the podcast since 2012. All my best to the happy couple, and my thanks to Jesse for hanging in there with me for 8 years. Wow, 8 years. Hey, the Mercer Virus and Thomas in Kansas from all the way back in the TV tracks era, thank you for the love on iTunes. Those 5-star iTunes reviews really do help out, so thank you to the two of them. Vice has already posted the first episode from Season 2 of its Dark Side of the Ring series on its YouTube channel. I know it's region-locked, apparently, so some of you in other countries have not been able to access it early. That's part one of the 2-part Chris Benoit special that the producers worked on. It premieres this Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern on Vice. It's going to be a 2-hour special, back-to-back episodes, and then I think a half an hour post-show, talk show. So think something similar to what Talking Dead was or Talking Bad on AMC after Breaking Bad. So that's coming up on Tuesday. I was going to wait to watch the entire thing in one sitting, but I ended up watching part one last night. And I'm going to save my full review. I'll do a complete review of the double episode on next week's podcast. But I will say this. I will make a few points here about what I saw. It is every bit as tough to watch as people are saying it is. And I knew it would be, but it was even worse because they covered the death of Eddie Guerrero at length. It was almost like a Chris and Eddie episode, but I guess when you talk about Benoit, you really had to talk about Eddie because the two of them were just so close. And his death had such an impact on Chris and his psyche that you really can't talk about one without the other. And the Benoit murders are only revealed at the very end of the first episode. They don't really get into the details until, I guess, episode 2 on Tuesday. But I was not prepared to relive the Eddie stuff again. And I learned something I never even knew. I actually learned a few things that I never knew, which is why if you're somebody who has dismissed these shows because it's just rehashing stuff that we already know, you're not going to learn anything new, you're wrong. You know, they interview the key players involved who slip in little details that I had never heard about before. I didn't know about the accusations that Kevin Sullivan beat on Nancy when the two of them were together, which is basically what drove her into the arms of Chris Benoit. You know, the story over the years is that Sullivan and Benoit feuded in WCW and there was no love lost there, but Sullivan was the booker and he essentially booked his own divorce without even knowing it by putting the two of them together. And then in real life, they ended up coming together and he lost his wife. But I wasn't aware that there were accusations by Nancy, which her sister, who's in the special, talked about, that he had assaulted her on more than one occasion, and she just couldn't take it anymore. And that is effectively what drove her, for good, into the arms of Chris Benoit. Now, they tried to interview Kevin Sullivan for this, and he denied the allegations, and he refused to be interviewed for the episode. I had heard about things in the past involving Benoit and Nancy. You know, in the early 2000s, I know there was a time where I think she had filed, might have been a divorce petition, because she was very intimidated by Chris and worried about what he might do to her, and then she withdrew the petition. So I knew about that, but I did not know about the allegations against Kevin Sullivan. The main thing, though, that I did not know is when Chavo Guerrero found Eddie, when he found his uncle laying on the bathroom floor in that hotel room in Minneapolis, he was still alive. Eddie Guerrero was still alive. He had, you know, Eddie in his arms. He got down on the floor, had him in his arms. Eddie still had the toothbrush in his hand that I guess he was brushing his teeth with when he collapsed. And he was gurgling. He was making gurgling noises. And then Eddie just died in Chavo's arms. And I'm sure Chavo must have shared that detail in interviews before, but maybe I just overlooked it. I don't know, but I figured he found him unconscious and they just couldn't revive him or that he was already gone. I knew Chavo was the first person on the scene, that I knew, but I thought Eddie was basically gone at that point. But to hear him, you know, tell the story of how he felt Eddie go from warm to cold. So he knew he was still alive. He still had a pulse. His heart was still beating. And then that was a few seconds later, it was over. It sends a chill through your body. It was devastating to listen to him retell that story and to hear about Benoit's reaction when Chavo told him, because they were all going to meet downstairs, I think either to eat or to work out. I think to work out. And, you know, when Eddie didn't answer his wake-up call, that's when they contacted Chavo, and that's when they kind of barged into the room and had to break the door down because it was, you know, bolted shut, and he found Eddie. And then Chris calls him and says, hey, where are you guys? Because it was going to be the two of them, and I think maybe one of the referees, Scott Armstrong, meeting up. And to hear Chavo have to tell Chris, you know, Eddie passed away. And the sobbing. He said, Chris Benoit is a man that showed no emotion. He had never seen him show emotion or cry before or anything. And just the uncontrollable sobbing that he heard on the other end of the phone from Benoit. You know, Chris Jericho, who's going to be the narrator for the series, he's interviewed in this as well. And he talked about the funeral, at Eddie's funeral, the guttural moaning from Benoit. He cried on Jericho's shoulder so much that Jericho had a wet spot on his suit jacket that went all the way through to his shirt underneath. Now, Vicky Guerrero, she's one of the stars of this episode. She's interviewed quite a bit. She was talking about Benoit visiting her at her house after Eddie passed away, and one day finding him upstairs laying in their bed in the spot where Eddie used to sleep at night. Just sobbing. Uncontrollably. Clutching Eddie's pillow in his hand. You know, other times her kids would come downstairs and say, hey, Mom, you know, Chris is up in the gym again. He's crying. I mean, the love that Benoit had for that man. It almost seemed like an unhealthy obsession that Benoit had for Eddie. I know they were best friends, but you hear them describe his reactions to certain things, even as compared to Eddie's own family. And it just, something is just off. I mean, the closeness, at least from Benoit's end, bordered on unhealthy. And Eddie's death absolutely changed him. It destroyed him. It absolutely wrecked this man. Did it play a role in what he did later on in his life? We'll never know. You can't make excuses. We'll never know. You ask me, how could it not? Of course it did. Of course it did. He was never the same after Eddie died. That's what I'm getting from listening to every single person that knew him. And the way the episode ends, telling the story of Vince McMahon gathering everybody backstage at Raw the night they found out what happened and breaking the news to everybody that, you know, Benoit and Nancy and Daniel were found dead. And then Vicky is there. She starts just screaming and she has to be controlled or consoled rather by Chavo. Because she had gotten very, very close with Nancy. They were like thick as thieves. They became best friends after Eddie passed away. Nancy basically took care of her, would come to the house, would force her and say, you got to get up out of bed. You got to move on with your life. And she would, you know, just be there for her. She would be there for her as a friend. She would be there for her as a shoulder to cry on. And then for Vicky to hear the news that all of them were found dead, it's just heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. So if you don't want to revisit those days again, because it is very dark, then I would say stay away. Some people just can't handle, they don't want to deal, they don't want to relive awful stuff like that. It's like people who say they don't want to go back and, you know, reread every year, you know, what happened on 9/11 all those years ago. It's hard to believe that's almost 20 years ago, by the way. Some people just don't want to get back in that headspace, and I get that, but the episode was very well done. I didn't think it was sensationalistic at all. It was very well done, and they interviewed all of the right people you would want them to interview. It's very dark, but very good. And I expect the Owen Hart episode. I don't know if that's going to be the next one. I don't know, you know, exactly when the Owen Hart one is going to air, but the Owen Hart episode, I would imagine, is going to be very similar. It's going to be much of the same. So I'll have a full review of both episodes on the podcast next week. So watch for that. And again, if you want to watch part one early and you do live in this country where you should be able to access it, just go to the Vice YouTube channel. All of part one is up there for you to watch. And if you are in another country, you know, one way to get around that region blocking probably is to use a VPN. And I'm just saying, if you want to give it a shot, I think the link that, you know, they assigned to me is still active, expressvpn.com/Solomonster. I think it gives you a 1-year subscription with, I think, 3 months free or 3 months tacked on. I don't have the exact offer in front of me, but really any VPN that you use, a lot of people use VPNs to get around that. So if you can't wait another 24 hours, or I guess it's a little more than that, 48 hours, for it to air on Vice, or if you don't have the Vice network, that would be one way to get around that restriction. The world continues to suck. No other way to put it. We are officially on lockdown here in New York after 8 p.m. tonight. Shelter in place, whatever you want to call it. Like most businesses, I'm working from home, as probably many of you are. I'm otherwise doing okay. I hope all of you are. You know, no matter how rough it may be, you always have the sound off. I told you that last week. This podcast isn't going anywhere. I am distressed at them closing down all of the barbershops indefinitely. 6 more months of this, and I'm going to come out of this quarantine looking like Jeremiah Johnson. I mean, I could ask my brother to cut my hair, but I may as well take a weed whacker to my head. I'd probably get better results. On the flip side, though, I've got my lawnmower trimmer here, so I will be perfectly manscaped when we all come out of this, which I'm sure is something that you all wanted to know. Since last week's show, a lot has changed, starting with WrestleMania. Tampa waited 36 years to get WrestleMania, and they may have to wait another 36 because WrestleMania has moved out of Tampa to the WWE Performance Center in Orlando. So it's staying in Florida, just a different part of Florida, in what will be the first ever empty arena WrestleMania, a show that would have packed in 60,000 people based on the current number of tickets sold and made millions of dollars for WWE. It would have made tens of millions of dollars for the local community, for the local economy. It will instead play to an audience of none outside of essential personnel only. Not only will there be no fans in attendance for WrestleMania, in another first 3 months after New Japan did the same thing with its Wrestle Kingdom show, WrestleMania will be divided into two nights, Saturday, April 4th and Sunday, April 5th, and it will be taped in advance. In fact, they are taping WrestleMania this week. If there is anything worse than a WrestleMania with no fans, it is a two-day taped WrestleMania with no fans. Like, at the beginning of the year, if you would have asked me, how would I go about making WrestleMania absolutely insufferable? I don't even think I could have thought up an idea of an empty arena show spread out over two nights that didn't even air live. Who would have even conceived of this? But these are the circumstances that we find ourselves in, and it's the reason why I cannot come at WWE for it. You know, believe me, I think the idea of a WrestleMania with no fans absolutely sucks. It does. It sucks. WrestleMania with no fans and no pyro and no pomp and circumstance is not WrestleMania. It is WrestleMania in name only. But WWE was placed in an impossible situation. Now, I know it was ultimately a Vince McMahon call. He had the final say in whether or not they postponed the event or if they moved ahead with it. And I saw WrestleVotes, I think on Twitter, was the one to post that, he was hearing that a lot of the talent internally was hoping that WrestleMania would be postponed. They didn't want to necessarily go ahead with it in front of an empty building at the Peace. Now, whether that's because they just didn't want to perform in front of no fans, or if there are fears for their own health and safety, that I don't know. But apparently a lot of the internal sentiment from the talent was that they were hoping that Vince McMahon would postpone it. He made a different decision. He decided to go in a different direction. If we had an end date for all of this madness, the thing to do would have been to delay it. But there is no end date for what we are going through right now. In fact, there's a lot of very reputable doctors and health experts and people that, you know, when I listen to them and I read their, when I read their positions on things, they seem pretty trustworthy. They know far more about this stuff than you or I do, who think this could carry on for a year or longer. I don't even want to think about that. The thought of that scares me stiff. That would be death for the wrestling business. And nobody wants to see that. But it could happen. But there were a lot of people involved in this process, planning for the show, planning for WrestleMania, putting all sorts of plans together for the show. It's not just a one-man show. Vince McMahon has final say, and it's his vision and all that. It's his company. It's his show. But he's not the only one working hard and putting plans for months in advance together to make WrestleMania happen. And I'm sure they all wanted this show to go off without a hitch, and there was a lot of work being put into it, but ultimately this is the answer that they came up with. And because of all the uncertainty, you know, Vince felt that we got to move. We got to move ahead. We got to wrap up these storylines. We got to do these matches now because we may not be able to do them later on. If for whatever reason we can't get this done later on, then there could be no WrestleMania at all. He just obviously felt that was not an acceptable alternative. I'm not going to tar and feather WWE for making the call that they made, even if I hate that they did it. I don't envy the position that they're in right now. I'm sure everybody there is stressed to the max. It is a risk to be doing this because if any of their talent gets sick in these next few weeks, you know, the whole thing, the whole company, the whole everything they do could end up being shut down anyway. I was going to say there's still a chance WrestleMania won't happen, but if they're going to tape this week, then that cuts down on that possibility. But who knows? Even in the next few days, things are changing every day, every hour. If they wait until Wednesday, Thursday to tape WrestleMania, who knows what could happen even between now and then? This is their fail-safe. Let's get this done now. We can get it into editing. It'll be in the can. It'll be ready to go when we need it. You know, the idea that people were hoping for it to be postponed to June and do it in Madison Square Garden. Look, I'd love to see WrestleMania back one more time in Madison Square Garden. But the idea that by June, everything is going to be reopened. Madison Square Garden, which is closed, is going to be reopened and back to near normal again. You are living in Candyland. You are living in Candyland. Tell Jolly and Lord Licorice that Solomonster said hello. You know, Tom Brady, he's a Buccaneer now. He has left the New England Patriots behind. He turns 43 years old this summer. He may not suit up and play until he's 44 at the rate that things are going. Everything is in this state of suspended animation. Everything. The Hall of Fame ceremony, NXT TakeOver Tampa, they have been postponed. Well, I mean, TakeOver Tampa has been canceled. Hall of Fame has been postponed indefinitely. They will not be taking place WrestleMania weekend. Georgia Smith, the daughter of Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog, who's being inducted this year, claimed that WWE told her they were hoping to postpone the Hall of Fame until SummerSlam weekend in Boston. I think that would be a great idea, assuming there is a SummerSlam in Boston. Jushin Thunder Liger, he was finally announced for the 2020 class this week. Who knows if he'll even get the chance to accept in person? I know it's something he really wanted to do. They interviewed him in Japan earlier in the week when he found out, or when it was officially announced, that he was going into the Hall of Fame. And he said, with everything going on, all the uncertainty, he was hoping it would be pushed back so he could be there in person to accept. It sounds like to him, it's a big deal and he'd like to be there for it. I hope he has that chance. One of the things that I am intrigued by with this WrestleMania is that it will apparently be taped from multiple locations. The PC will be the primary location, but some matches are going to be taped elsewhere on other closed sets to cut down on the number of people together all in one place, since, you know, the guidelines had suggested no more than 50 people in one place. Now that recommendation is down to 10, which, if that were a mandate, would make it impossible to film any wrestling shows. You cannot do a wrestling show with a closed set of under 10 people. It's not practical. But the idea of maybe doing, for example, Edge and Randy Orton, last man standing, in a backlot somewhere, like Roddy Piper and Goldust back in 96, that could be interesting. You know, if they film it like a movie, or if they film it like something you would have seen on an episode of Lucha Underground, that could be pretty cool. You know, John Cena against The Fiend. Maybe in a funhouse match. They could create some kind of funhouse that Cena has to enter. I mean, I know they did a match with Orton and Wyatt once from the Sister Abigail Shack, or whatever it was. And, I mean, that was certainly interesting. But, yeah, maybe they do something similar, but in a funhouse type of environment. Yeah, that might not be the worst idea, having rewatched their match from WrestleMania 30, which they re-aired on SmackDown this week in its entirety. It wasn't very good. It was a very story-based match. The story worked. The story was, you know, you could follow the story. Bray was playing mind games with Cena. Cena was, you know, scared by the crab walk, which looked ridiculous, but whatever. The wrestling itself was no good. So maybe a match outside of an actual wrestling ring might not be such a terrible idea. But you know, when they filmed that Piper Goldust backlot brawl for WrestleMania 12, or the Boiler Room Brawl that same year for SummerSlam with Mankind and The Undertaker, those matches were taped either a day in advance or as much as a week in advance. I think it might have been a week with the Piper match. I don't remember. So they've done these types of matches before, you know, where they could tape them in advance and edit them any which way they want to. You can edit them to make it look like a horror movie if you wanted to. Just thinking outside the box. So I am intrigued at this concept of doing it from multiple locations. If they're just going to go in the back and just film something in the back, I don't know, that they could do that, I guess. That's kind of lame. If you're going to do it, be creative with it. Think outside the box. You could pick a couple of matches. It may only be two. And come up with something creative if you're going to film it from another location. Now, per PW Insider, the taping schedule looks like this. They taped two episodes of SmackDown at the PC yesterday. That's for this upcoming Friday and the following Friday. They also taped two episodes of 205 Live for the five people who were interested in knowing that. Today, they're taping material for upcoming NXT episodes. Tomorrow night, Raw will air live on the USA Network. And then on Tuesday, they're going to be taping two episodes of Raw that will take them through all the way to April 6th, which is the night after WrestleMania. So that big night after WrestleMania Raw where they have all the international fans there and it's all raucous and the, you know, the wild and crazy crowds, that Raw will already be taped for 2 weeks. That's going to be weird because they're going to be taping that before WrestleMania. It sounds like the night after WrestleMania Monday Night Raw is actually being taped in advance of WrestleMania. This is almost like a, reminds me of those old WCW taping schedules from the early to mid 90s. They would sometimes tape things completely out of order. Somebody would come out with a title they hadn't won yet. And that's kind of what may end up happening here. WrestleMania itself, or at least the parts of WrestleMania from the PC, they're going to be taped over the course of Tuesday and Wednesday. And it just sounds so weird for me to even be saying that, taping WrestleMania. So that means WrestleMania is going to be in the can for about 10 days, 9 or 10 days before it even airs on TV. And with it being a closed set, that should at least hopefully mean no spoilers leaking, but there's no guarantee of that. There's always the risk of somebody leaking spoilers. I would suggest taping multiple finishes for at least the big matches. That way you can't be sure which finish they might actually go with. You can film Goldberg beating Roman Reigns. You can film Roman Reigns beating Goldberg. You can film Undertaker beating AJ Styles and film AJ Styles beating The Undertaker. And have multiple finishes to throw people off to, if they're that paranoid about spoilers possibly leaking. That's about the only way you can really combat that sort of thing. But the fact that I'm even talking about them doing this, it just sounds so wrong. It's very weird. Most people are going to watch it, if you do watch WrestleMania, most people are going to watch it through the WWE Network, because if not, you're going to be left paying $60 or $70 for a taped WrestleMania on pay-per-view, which I think is crazy. I know Dave Meltzer was told by WWE that depending on your provider for pay-per-view, you would either pay one price and get both shows, because it's two nights, or you'll have to order the shows individually, and maybe you'd get the second night at half price. Don't do that. Unless you live in a wooded area somewhere where you just can't get access to the WWE Network and your Wi-Fi is not strong enough. I don't know where you would be living if that were the case, but I suppose it's possible. Otherwise, please pay the $9.99 if you want to watch WrestleMania. Or look, hey, get it however you're going to get it. But if you want to get it on the up and up, just pay the $9.99 for the network and watch both shows. Please don't go spending $70 or $100 for both shows. That is insanity. One place that WrestleMania will not be airing this year is ESPN+. Discussions may still be ongoing between the two sides. I remember WWE is trying to reach a deal. Vince McMahon on the last conference call thought that they could have a deal struck by the end of March. I'm sure he didn't predict that we'd be going through what we're going through right now. But that was his thought process. He thought they were far enough along that, you know, they would be able to reach some kind of deal even before WrestleMania. That is not going to happen. It is too late for that to happen in time for this year's Mania. But WWE and ESPN have reached an agreement. ESPN is really hurting right now. They have no new sports to cover. Each of the next three Sundays, starting tonight, they are going to be airing a full WrestleMania show, starting with WrestleMania 30, tonight at 7 Eastern. This is after they just showed a match on Fox Friday night from that WrestleMania show in its entirety. So great timing there. The following Sunday, March 29, will be WrestleMania 32, which was a bad WrestleMania. And then April 5th at 3 p.m., because that night is WrestleMania 36, they will be airing WrestleMania 35 from last year, with Kofi Kingston winning the WWE Championship and, well, Kofi Kingston winning the WWE Championship. There really is nothing else worth sitting through again on that show that I can think of. I don't know which one of you is going to sit there and watch 4 hours of WrestleMania on Saturday night, and then turn around and watch WrestleMania 35 and Night 2 of WrestleMania 36 back-to-back on Sunday for 8 hours, but may God have mercy on your soul if you are one of those people. If ESPN is so desperate for content, I would reach a deal with them to air some of those great WWE 24 documentaries on there from their own network. That is some award-winning, award-worthy material that WWE has in their archives that they have worked on. I could see that happening, you know, if it were to happen. I could see that appealing to non-wrestling fans that may watch ESPN more than the actual wrestling would appeal to them. Now, if you're not a wrestling fan and you watch sports, first of all, you probably thumb your nose at pro wrestling, as a lot of sports fans do. But if you're not a wrestling fan, you don't care. They're going to air WrestleMania 30. They're going to air, even if they aired this year's WrestleMania, what do you really care? Is that show? Are any of these current WWE shows really going to turn you on to becoming a new fan? Probably not. Too many people are going to be converted just by watching one of the current shows. But I think there could be an appeal if they watch one of these documentaries that kind of took you behind the scenes and you got to learn how the show works. Or if it focused on one particular individual who had a very compelling story. You know, ESPN has those 30 for 30 specials. I think that material could have a lot of appeal, even to non-wrestling fans. So that's the sort of thing, if ESPN is going to be needing content in the months to come. Those things are usually about an hour long each. They could tap into WWE. They could tap into their archives and start airing some of those specials. Now, the card for this year's show seems mostly set at this point. Brock Lesnar defends the WWE Championship against Drew McIntyre. Lesnar is scheduled to be on Monday Night Raw tomorrow night at the PC, but, you know, I asked the question last week. I wasn't sure whether or not Brock was still living in Canada. Apparently, he is. He's still living up in Saskatchewan. And the border between the U.S. and Canada, in case you didn't know, has been closed to everything but essential travel only. Now, what qualifies as essential travel? That I'm not sure what the criteria is. If you are employed and you work in this country, is that not considered essential? Is it first responder? I don't know. I would think Brock would be okay. He's got American citizenship, but there's no guarantee that he'll be able to get across. I would not want to be the Border Patrol agent giving Brock Lesnar a hard time trying to get to work this week. Got Roman Reigns challenging Goldberg for the Universal Championship. I'll talk about their contract signing a little later. John Cena battles The Fiend, Bray Wyatt. Undertaker takes on AJ Styles. Randy Orton will answer Edge's challenge tomorrow night to a last man standing match. You know, if Randy Orton was a real heel, if he was a real chicken shit heel, he'd come on Raw via satellite, wouldn't even be there in person. He'd show up on Raw on the Tron tomorrow night. And he would say, "I don't feel safe traveling." And he would turn down the match. That's what I would do. I'm not leaving my house. He's got a perfectly built-in excuse to say no to Edge. Charlotte Flair takes on Rhea Ripley for the NXT Women's Championship. Poor Rhea. They did that great video on her on NXT a couple weeks ago where she was in an empty Raymond James Stadium, taking a look around, getting a taste of what it's going to be like to walk out in front of this big stadium for the first time in her career. Unfortunately for her, Raymond James Stadium will be empty on April 5th as well. Becky Lynch defends her Raw Women's Championship against Shayna Baszler. Shayna Baszler is going to have to find a new hobby. She can't go around biting people anymore. It's not safe. Bayley defends her SmackDown Women's Championship in a six-pack challenge against Sasha Banks, Lacey Evans, Naomi, Dana Brooke, and Tamina. Tamina. Why the fuck is Tamina wrestling for the championship at WrestleMania? Just do Sasha against Bayley. Why do they need to overthink these things? Bayley said it herself on Friday night. I've already beaten all of these other women. She's had matches with Dana Brooke. She's had matches with Naomi. She's had matches with Lacey Evans. Multiple matches with Lacey Evans. She's beaten them all. All but Sasha Banks. Just do Bayley against Sasha. I hate this six-pack challenge shit so much. It will be an elimination match, though. So maybe it'll come down to Bayley and Sasha at the end, but you still don't need six women in this match. Seth Rollins is going to take on Kevin Owens. And we may be getting a triple threat for the Intercontinental title, with Sami Zayn defending against Daniel Bryan and Drew Gulak. That is if Gulak can beat Shinsuke Nakamura this Friday on SmackDown. And LOL Braun Strowman, not even getting a rematch for the championship. I'll deal with him in a little bit. We are likely going to get some sort of multi-team match for the women's tag team titles. Asuka is going to be facing Alexa Bliss this Friday. And there's still talk of Beth Phoenix maybe teaming up with Natalya. And I guess we'll see. We'll see ultimately what the match is. If it's just going to be Alexa and Nikki against Asuka and Kairi, or if they'll add a third team in there. And I would have to think we'll get some kind of a match involving Dolph Ziggler and Otis. Or maybe a tag team match involving those two and Mandy Rose in some capacity. If there's one good thing, and you know what really is sad about that? I've really been digging that story with Otis and Mandy, and it's been going on for a long time. And I don't know if the idea was to pay it off at WrestleMania, right after WrestleMania, or how long they were going to drag this out for originally. But one of the things I was looking forward to was the big payoff. Or if there was some kind of big swerve or some big climactic moment at the end of all this to see what the crowd, you know, how the crowd would react. Crowd's really been into Otis now for a long time. And you just kind of build it and wait for that big payoff. And now you're not going to get it, not at least not with the audience present. You're not going to get that big payoff and the big reaction. Or if Otis does come together with Mandy, if Mandy was going to give him a kiss, you're not going to have that moment now where the fans, you know, cheer for Otis and they go crazy. And that sucks. That really sucks. Because I was looking forward to the big, that big moment. And look, I'm not even saying they're going to put Mandy together with Otis at the end of all this. But you have to think, you know, they want you to think that Mandy would never date Otis and she would never kiss Otis. It's like, you know, Beauty and the Beast type of thing. And I'm sure that's where this is all leading to. Her at least planning a big wet one on this guy. At least if I'm him, I'm hoping. If I'm working this storyline, I'm like, hey, I'm biding my time. I can't wait for this storyline to pay off. But you're not going to get that reaction now. Sucks. If there's one good thing to all of this, is that there will be no meaningless battle royals at WrestleMania this year. Pro Wrestling Sheet said that due to the CDC guidelines, you know, wanting to cut down on mass gatherings, they want to cut down on the number of people in the ring at once. So, no men's or women's battle royals this year at WrestleMania. Hallelujah. At least we get one positive thing out of this. Now, WrestleCon had been waiting for WWE or for the city of Tampa to blink first and make a decision on WrestleMania before deciding what they were going to do with their own convention. I said last week the owner of WrestleCon and High Spots, he stood to lose his own house. He thought that he and his wife would have to sell their home. If things really went south, if Vince McMahon were to cancel WrestleMania before the city of Tampa would pull the plug on it. So WWE did make the call this week to not cancel WrestleMania, but to move it from Tampa and relocate to Orlando. At that point, they officially canceled WrestleCon, and that put them in a real tough spot with Marriott Hotels, which said that the cancellation would cause damages to the hotel that they booked. And they said the liquidated damages due to the hotel is 80% of the total revenue owed to the hotel, which is over $114,000. And that's when Chris Jericho and a whole bunch of different wrestlers from all over the wrestling world, WWE, AEW, and beyond, they came together in their calls for Marriott to do the right thing. And eventually Marriott caved and they did do the right thing. Although, you know, part of that probably had to do with the governor of Florida issuing a emergency declaration to cancel events over the next 30 days. That certainly played a role, I think, in Marriott changing its tune. But, you know, the pressure from the wrestlers helped as well. And look, remember, a lot of these wrestlers are, you know, patrons of Marriott. You know, they travel all the time. They stay at hotels all the time. There's a lot of wrestlers that give Marriott a lot of business throughout the year. So it's amazing what can get done when people come together and put pressure on someone to do the right thing. All 3,500 plus guests will be given refunds on their orders. So if you bought a ticket to WrestleCon, you've got to give it time, but you will get your money back. Some other updates. The Alabama Athletic Commission has temporarily stopped issuing permits for pro wrestling events in the state. Do they even have a state athletic commission in Florida? I mean, it's Florida, so I have to ask the question. If they do, they better hope they don't issue a similar order there, or else WWE and AEW both are going to be screwed. Ring of Honor made the decision to cancel all of its events through May 31st. All Honor Club subscribers will have 3 months added to their subscriptions to make up for the 3 months they're effectively going to be shut down. The NWA, I didn't have an update on them last week, now I do. The NWA canceled the Crockett Cup set for April 19th, as well as their TV taping scheduled for the 2 days after. Their hope is that business can resume in June. In the meantime, they'll produce other content for their YouTube channel. And they put together some pretty good stuff. I mean, you think about the 10 Pounds of Gold series, a lot of the stuff that you know, Dave Lagana has worked on. Really good stuff. And I think that's going to be a good way to keep up with the NWA and its personalities, if they put those types of videos out. That can tide them over for a while. But as with all these promotions, you can only do that for so long. After a while, people are going to want to see wrestling. In Japan, things are slowly getting back to normal. The problem seemed to be limited now to only three parts of the country. You know, Japan is obviously not quite as large as the U.S., which is why our problems are very different. But Stardom, Dragon Gate, and DDT are all resuming shows. New Japan has not yet made an announcement about what its plans are, but they do still have their Sakura Genesis show on the calendar for March 31st. That hasn't been officially canceled, I don't believe. So we'll see what they decide to do. And the XFL suspended the remainder of its 2020 season after just 5 weeks of play. Players are allowed to sign with NFL teams if any are interested in them. And they do hope to be back for a full season in 2021. I'll get to Raw and SmackDown in a bit. But AEW aired its first empty arena show, its first empty arena Dynamite, in Jacksonville on Wednesday from Daly's Place. I did a live stream after the show. Went 2.5 hours, including all your phone calls. And AEW did something that WWE failed to do with its own empty arena shows. They knocked it out of the park with one of their best shows of the year. They made the best of a bad situation. And they delivered what I thought was a very entertaining 2 hours. I haven't checked the final results of the Twitter poll, but it was probably the widest margin of a positive result for an AEW poll since I started putting them up. Last I checked, it was around 89 or 90% positive, with something like 3,000 or 4,000 votes in. A big advantage that they had over WWE was having a bigger venue. than the Performance Center. The Performance Center is basically a glorified warehouse. I mean, if you look at it and you listen with nobody there to the echoes and everything, it's like they're performing inside of a warehouse. Now, it's a very fancy warehouse. It's a $5 million warehouse, but it's a small, relatively small building. And here, you know, because they were in Daly's Place, and Daly's Place is not exactly a gigantic venue either, but compared to the PC, it's a big building, and they were able to have pyro, and they put wrestlers in the first few rows of the crowd, spaced out accordingly, so that they, you know, weren't all condensed together, social distancing, so they had plenty of room to spread them out. You had MJF in the crowd, Shawn Spears, Tully Blanchard, Wardlow, Joey Janela, Colt Cabana, they were all around ringside throughout the show, cheering and booing and making noise, and that noise helped a lot. If you have an empty arena, you need to create noise somehow. At the PC, you can hear the ceiling fans. You can hear the production people. Go back and watch the very end of SmackDown as they were going off the air with Goldberg and Roman Reigns going face-to-face. And you can hear them, you know, I don't know who it was. I don't know if it was Kevin Dunn or somebody else. In someone's headset, it was coming through on TV, telling them, go to this camera angle, this camera angle, this camera angle. And that was coming through. It was so silent. It was so quiet in there. It was coming through on TV. I mean, they cut it out of the YouTube video. But I thought that was actually kind of funny. But yeah, if you've got an empty arena, if you've got an empty building, you've got to find a way, you know, what I think we have realized these last couple of weeks, you've got to find a way to create noise. And I thought AEW did a far more effective job at doing that than WWE did. Now, the other smart thing that they did was they used a hard camera view of the ring with the rampway and the tunnels in the background, the heel tunnel and the babyface tunnel. You saw that if you were watching on TV on Wednesday night in the background, instead of shooting it in a way where the audience at home saw nothing but empty chairs in the background. That was smart of them to shoot it that way. Tony Schiavone was there. He was interviewing people throughout the night. He was the designated interview correspondent. And, you know, MJF was at ringside. He was betting on the matches with Shawn Spears. They had Jim Ross, Taz, and Excalibur on commentary. And, they were, you know, very loosey-goosey. They were having a good time. JR and Tony were kind of ribbing each other at one point. And the show was really highlighted by two big debuts, including the long-awaited reveal of the Exalted One of the Dark Order, who turned out not to be Matt Hardy, but Brody Lee, the former Luke Harper, who would have been debuting in his hometown of Rochester had they not been forced to move the show. They laid out SCU. Now we get to see what Brody Lee can do as the leader of his own faction instead of being a follower in one. Does he have the chops to make it work? Or was Vince McMahon right all along? We're about to find out. When he told Christopher Daniels, "You're not the first out-of-touch old man not to believe in me, but you're damn sure going to be the last," that was such a money line. I love that. I also love the Jake Roberts Lance Archer vignette out in the woods with Archer beating up random scrubs in a ring in the middle of nowhere while, you know, Jake is just lounging back in a lawn chair or whatever kind of chair it was, smoking a cigarette, just watching. And then at the end of the show, after the Inner Circle won the man advantage over the Elite in their upcoming Blood and Guts match, they certainly wanted you to think that it was going to be Jon Moxley taking the place of the injured Nick Jackson, tagging with the Elite for the Blood and Guts match. But instead, we see Vanguard 1 hovering overhead, and then up in the cheap seats, there's broken Matt Hardy to close out the show. And it will be Matt Hardy tagging with the Elite against the Inner Circle in the Blood and Guts match. It sucks that they couldn't have done this in front of a packed crowd, because the reaction for this would have blown the roof off the place. But I thought they handled it as well as they could. You know, AEW made those WWE shows at the PC feel inferior by comparison. I mean, they're working within the confines of what they have to work with, you know, in that building. But so far, they have chosen to fill time, WWE has, by airing an entire Royal Rumble match and a WrestleMania match from 6 years ago. Raw on Monday night had exactly one match in the ring. NXT had no matches, But Raw had one match. They did a better job, at least on Friday night. They had more matches. But there is no excuse for AEW to be able to go out and put on a show like this and have WWE put on those shows by comparison. There's no excuse. It's like they weren't even trying. Now, if they insist on doing more shows from the PC, they need to learn from what AEW did, because if this is the way these shows are going to be every week, look, Raw and SmackDown are going to do a lot more viewers than AEW does. We know this. They are established shows. You know, Raw and SmackDown have been on the air a long time. WWE is very fortunate to have a very loyal base of fans that will watch no matter what, through thick and thin. Even through a plague. They will watch Raw, they will watch SmackDown. Now look, it helps to have Stone Cold Steve Austin announced for the show, or John Cena, or Goldberg. I'm sure that's a big part of why they've been able to hold on, you know, to their audience in the last few weeks. They've promoted some big names. They had Edge come back on Monday night. Undertaker. So it helps. It helps to kind of throw the big guns out there. But they're very fortunate to have a very dedicated, very loyal base of fans. We already know Raw and SmackDown, they're going to just demolish AEW when it comes to the numbers on TV. But if I were a new viewer tuning in to these shows, I would be far more inclined to want to watch AEW than I would WWE after what I've seen the last 2 weeks. Now, even though they were promoting the Blood and Guts War Games match for the next, quote-unquote, next episode of Dynamite, they never said next week, because things are changing every day. We don't know from one day to the next what kind of restrictions or bans may be announced to where they're just simply not allowed to run shows anymore. But it appears their plans have changed, because the next episode of Dynamite is going to be this Wednesday back at Daly's Place in Jacksonville. But it will not feature the Blood and Guts match. Tony Khan announced the following on Friday. This is what Tony Khan said. Said, our goal every week with AEW Dynamite on TNT is to produce great shows for our fans, and I believe we do. We felt especially motivated to serve our audience on Wednesday, given what the world is coping with, and hopefully we gave them a well-deserved escape during these trying times. Everyone at AEW is very proud of what we delivered and humbled by the response. We plan to continue answering that calling with live weekly shows every Wednesday, but the time and circumstances are not right for the card that we had planned next week for Blood and Guts. That show will happen when the time is right. What you can count on instead this coming Wednesday is a great live episode featuring Chris Jericho confronting Matt Hardy face-to-face, one-on-one, for the first time ever, and a tremendous night of wrestling action. Now, he says it's not the right time for that card. He didn't just say the match. He said the card. So it makes me wonder if we're still getting that parking lot fight that they promoted between the Best Friends and the Lucha Bros. Or the lumberjack match between Wardlow and Luchasaurus. He almost made it sound like those matches might not be happening either. I'm fine with them delaying the Blood and Guts match. It's a match that deserves a hot crowd. But again, I'm also not going to shit on WWE for moving ahead with WrestleMania, because Tony Khan is taking a chance by doing this. Tony Khan, unlike WWE and what they're doing as we speak this week, this weekend, AEW is not taping a whole bunch of shows in advance. You heard Tony Khan in that statement. They're prepared to go live every Wednesday from Jacksonville if they have to, and do one live show per week. WWE doesn't know what's going to be, so they're taping a whole bunch of shows. They're basically taping everything to cover the next 2 to 3 weeks, including WrestleMania. Because they just don't know what's going to be, or maybe they just want to be able to send people home and not make it so that they have to keep flying into Orlando. But Tony Khan is taking a chance by doing this. If things continue to be bad and the live crowds are not able to come back to the arenas for another 6 months or worse, if this carries over into next year, that's a long time to delay that Blood and Guts match. And to keep this feud fresh, and to keep this feud going between the Inner Circle and the Elite, they're taking a chance by doing that. I would have been okay with Vince McMahon postponing WrestleMania, but I also understand him wanting to get it done now. Tony Khan made the opposite call. He decided, however long it takes, that match needs to happen in front of a live audience. And I respect his decision. Time will tell if that was the right one. It's worth noting that the MGM Grand in Las Vegas, which is the scheduled site for the Double or Nothing pay-per-view Memorial Day weekend, is one of the many MGM properties that have suspended operations until further notice with everything going on. So that's another show that's in jeopardy right now. It's not looking too good for Double or Nothing, unless they move that to Jacksonville too. Speaking of Matt Hardy, he was the guest on this week's Talk is Jericho. Not ideal timing, dropping this now and then having a face-to-face between them on TV this week, a few days later, but I guess kayfabe died long ago. This was a great interview. You know, Matt, you know, just to rehash just some of the key points, Matt made it clear he left WWE because he could not get any assurance from Vince McMahon that he would be taken care of creatively, or he would have his ideas listened to creatively. He talked about his idea for the storyline with Bray Wyatt. If you remember, they were tag team partners for a while. How Bray would be freed from Sister Abigail, and he would become this lovable type of character, and they would shoot a whole bunch of entertaining vignettes to show a different side of his personality. WWE instead wanted to put their stamp on it and basically ruin the whole thing. They wanted them to wrestle tag team matches every week to fill time on those three-hour Raw shows. Vince McMahon just didn't get the Broken Matt stuff. And not everybody was a fan of it. I'm not saying Vince McMahon is the only person who didn't like Broken Matt. I loved it. But I also heard from a lot of you guys, some of you just absolutely hated it. You don't like that kind of really over-the-top, fake, goofy type of stuff. And a lot of people just did not like the Broken Matt character. I think more liked it than not. But it doesn't sound like Vince McMahon even understood it. He didn't get it. But when you look at some of the stupid, goofy bullshit that Vince McMahon has put on his own TV show, really? You're gonna look at the Broken Matt stuff and say, oh, I don't get it. I don't understand it. When you consider some of the shit that this guy has put on his own TV show, some of the dumb shit that he's done. He confirmed that Triple H did reach out to him after his contract expired, which backs up the reports of them trying to maybe make a deal for him to work with NXT. One of the most revealing comments in the entire interview was Matt admitting that had Triple H been the sole one in power in the company, if he had taken over from Vince McMahon and Triple H was the one running WWE, it's very likely he would have stayed with the company. Now, if Matt Hardy is saying this, and Matt Hardy spent a lot of years working for WWE, he's a veteran of the company, then you know he's not the only one who must feel this way. How many other people would have stayed when their contract came up? How many more people are going to leave who perhaps otherwise would have stayed if there was some new blood in power? I say new blood, I mean Triple H has been there forever, but he's not been in charge. We still don't know what a Triple H-led WWE would look like. Maybe it would be worse. I don't think it would be worse. Maybe it would be. Maybe he doesn't run WWE the same way that he's run NXT. Maybe he lets the power go to his head and he becomes as bad as Vince. with some of these decisions. Who knows? Until he's actually in that position, if he ever gets there, we just don't know. But that was a very revealing comment. Maybe probably the biggest reveal, I think, in the entire interview, hearing him say that. He credited TV shows like True Blood with the genesis of the Broken Matt character, the idea of souls living in different vessels across multiple time periods. One of the most impressive things about this interview, as I'm listening to him speak, especially in the first like half hour, was you listen to Matt explain to Jericho the backstory of the broken character, the broken universe, some of the other ideas, crazy ideas, that he had over the years. How he breaks things down, how he explains, well, you know, this character, this means this and that. And Jericho's laughing. I mean, he's sitting there laughing, not because he thinks it's stupid, but because he can't believe the level of detail, and the level of thought, the degree of thought that was put into these ideas. When you listen to him speak, you really do realize how freaking creative this guy really is. I mean, I've always heard that you know, that Matt is really the brains of the Hardy Boys, and, you know, he could book a promotion all by himself, and he's got all these great ideas, and Jeff is more of the daredevil who just goes out and does the crazy moves. And I'm not saying Jeff isn't a creative guy either. Jeff is kind of a bizarre guy. You know, but Jeff also is creative in his own way. You know, the artwork, the music that he does. But when you listen to Matt really break these ideas down, you realize how creative a person he really is. And the thought that he would be pitching constant ideas to the company and they would all just fall on deaf ears, not one of them would break through. What does that say about the company itself and their willingness to accept ideas? Forget outside ideas. They don't accept pitches from fans and things like that, but even just the talent themselves. I understand they employ this army of writers. And if you're a writer in WWE, maybe you look at that and go, wait a minute. Yeah, if we start accepting ideas from the wrestlers, then what do you need writers for? Maybe they feel threatened. Maybe they feel their job is in jeopardy. I could see the writers not necessarily being too keen on the wrestlers, you know, submitting their own ideas. But you would think, you know, these are the people who were portraying the characters. I'm sure a lot of wrestlers have a lot of really terrible ideas that deserve to be rejected. I'm sure of it. You can make a list probably of a lot of great ideas that have been submitted by wrestlers and then make a list of all the awful ones. The awful ones may well outrank the good ones, but the idea that a lot of the good ones just fall on deaf ears. I could see where people would feel stifled working for a company like that. If you care too much about what you do and it's not just about drawing a paycheck. I mean, look at the Revival. The Revival, they're as good as gone. You don't think the Revival could have taken a great deal that WWE was offering them and just stayed for the money? You know, now with everything going on, you know, they may have put themselves in a really awful position. You know, apparently they're not getting paid. They've already hit their downside guarantee, supposedly, and WWE's not even paying them, and they can't leave at the same time. I think Wilder maybe has more time on his deal because of injuries than Scott Dawson does. I think Dawson's deal supposedly is up in April. Wilder may not be free until June. They're not being paid, and now there's no wrestling at all. AEW is on a budget. You know, all of a sudden, all this talent that AEW was signing or looking to sign, in a few months, they may not be able to bring anybody new in. They may have to, in fact, they may have to scale back. If they're working on a fixed budget, the longer this whole situation goes on for, it's amazing to think how quickly things can change. I was just talking about the Revival not even a month ago, and look at the position that these guys are in. It's great, you know, they're biding their time. They're almost assuredly going to end up in AEW. And I'm sure they'll get a nice deal to go there, too. They're not going to be, you know, living paycheck to paycheck. But they've been waiting a very long time for their deals to run out. They've been biding their time. They've rejected every contract offer, supposedly, that's been presented to them. And then this happens. And now who knows what's going to be? You know, the wrestling business is not immune to what is going to be happening in other industries. Laying off workers. Contracting, scaling back, downsizing. Just because the Khan family is a billion-dollar family does not mean that AEW is, you know, it's just going to be business as usual. If they work on a budget and they have to stay within that budget, and now they're going to get slammed just like WWE and just like everybody else, and believe me, WWE, you know, they've made a lot more money than AEW has. All of a sudden, I don't know that, you know, people like the Revival are necessarily going to have a place to go when all of this is over. For their sake, I hope they do. But they may be rethinking their decision real soon, the longer this drags out for. Vanguard 1 made an appearance on Dynamite Wednesday night, but it would not have happened had the show taken place in Rochester. Building management did not want a drone flying above the crowd for safety reasons, and so what they would have had to do is either just not use the drone, or they would have shot something outside the building instead of having it land in the ring. Being inside an empty arena allowed them to use Vanguard 1. You know, it allowed them to use the drone, and something went wrong. Matt said that the drone was supposed to fly, you know, I don't know if it was going to land first and then get back in the air, but it was supposed to fly to him. And so the final shot of Dynamite was going to be Vanguard 1 flying to Broken Matt, and then you see the two of them, and that's the closing shot. For whatever reason, the drone landed in the ring, and I guess Vanguard 1 fell asleep. You know, maybe he was drinking, maybe he had a little too much, and he just kind of planted himself in the ring, and he didn't move. And so they had to improvise, and instead Matt was just pointing to the inner circle and taunting them and doing the delete gesture. So I thought that was kind of amusing. Vanguard 1 turned heel on Matt Hardy. I think one of the benefits of having Matt on their team now, if they have to, they could probably tape shows, entire shows, or at least tape certain segments, tape some material for upcoming Dynamite episodes from the Hardy compound. If they had to. And Matt, you know, his home there in North Carolina, I don't know how hard hit the state has been in terms of what's been happening, but he lives in the middle of nowhere. So, I mean, I guess he runs the risk when he's traveling around, but, you know, his family is pretty well safe. I mean, they're planted right there in the middle of absolutely nowhere in Cameron, North Carolina. I don't know if I would want to invite AEW to come film at my place. My place would be, if I were in that Hardy compound, that's like a safe zone. My family is safe. I don't want people from the outside coming into my home. But I suppose if they wanted to, then they could probably shoot some stuff there. Sad tweet this week is not a tweet, but an Instagram comment from Braun Strowman, whose account is under his real name, Adam Schur. He actually did have a sad tweet where he referred to Lance Archer as a great value brand version of himself. But he was tagged by somebody else who said, oh, Archer is what Braun should have been, and so he was only reacting. I can't hold that against him. You know, I just looked at that as some harmless trash talk. This was different. And I like Braun. You know, outside the ring, he seems like a good dude. But my God, this was just a tone-deaf, shitty thing for him to say. He left a comment under an Instagram post by Evil Uno of the Dark Order in AEW. But it wasn't actually Evil Uno's post. It was a screenshot of Evil Uno's post from an Instagram account dedicated to burying Smarks, which Braun evidently follows. I didn't see this until this week, even though the post looks to be from March 12, but in his tweet, Evil Uno said that in the wake of all of these cancellations, support the independents, be it wrestling, music, etc., buy their merch, support them through Patreon, share their stuff. The gig economy is going to take a huge hit, and many don't have the safety net necessary to survive this. To which Braun Strowman had this to say about his fellow performers. Said, here we go with more of the somebody pay my bills stuff. If you can't afford to pay your bills, maybe you should change professions. That's why I quit Strongman. I loved it, but I couldn't afford to live, so instead of making a GoFundMe or a Patreon wanting somebody else to take care of me, I went out and I worked harder than I ever have in my life to get to where I am. What happened to being accountable for your own actions? And that wasn't enough. He posted a follow-up. He said, and for anybody that goes, oh, that's easy for you to say you're a WWE superstar. 7 years ago, I moved to Florida with everything I owned in a Kia Soul with $150 in my pocket or to my name when I started this. That is an absurdly shitty thing to say to another wrestler when you have states going on lockdowns, telling people not to leave their homes. People who I know for a fact, in the case of many independent wrestlers, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them, who already have another job. How do you know that they don't have another job? A lot of them do. And with everything going on in the world right now, it's very possible that they may not have that job anymore. And now they can't wrestle either because everything's on lockdown. Everything's in suspended animation. So it could be dark days ahead. Evil Uno is asking people to support those folks if they can. That warrants a rant from Braun Strowman, who did strongman competitions. And he didn't make any money doing strongman competitions. So he packed up his Kia and he drove to Orlando to get paid to wrestle by WWE. It's a good thing this didn't happen when Braun had $150 in his pocket down in Orlando living out of his car. He might be singing a very different tune if that had happened. The reason a lot of these indie talents are going to be hurting is because we're in the middle of a crisis that you only see once in a lifetime. None of us have ever experienced anything like this before, not on this scale. It's a crisis that's very likely going to put tens of millions of people on the unemployment line, not just pro wrestlers. A lot of those people, by the way, have full-time jobs, good-paying jobs, where they work in restaurants, they work in bars. And because of the situation they now find themselves in, they may not be getting a paycheck anymore. But they were paying their bills just fine before. And now they may not be able to pay them at all. I wonder if Braun Strowman would tell those people the same thing. Oh, you should have changed professions, because now is a great time to go running out and working hard and just look for another job. Let's change professions now. You should have been smarter, like Braun. If Braun Strowman had dynamite for brains, he wouldn't be able to blow his nose. It's a lot of independent wrestlers who work hard. They were doing well. There's a booming indie scene who may have also had a day job, maybe, you know, even as a side hustle, and they wrestle at night or on weekends, whatever the case may be. Evil Uno, he came from that independent scene. He's probably friends, I'm willing to bet, with a lot of those guys. He's just trying to look out for some of them. Braun Strowman has no concept of that because he didn't come up through that scene. He drove his car to Florida with $150 in his pocket after he had already signed with WWE. I know it's more dramatic to say that, oh, I moved to another state, I had very little money in my pocket, as if he was driving down there on a wing and a prayer, hoping that they would just open the door when he knocked. He already had a well-paying contract by that point. Mark Henry, he took notice of him from the Strongman stuff. WWE came calling. They were offering him more money than Strongman, and that's why he took it. So he packed up his car, and he got paid to go to wrestling school. The fucking gall of this guy. You know how many wrestlers get paid to go to wrestling school? Not very many. They're usually the ones paying, and they do so willingly because this is something that they've always wanted to do. So they'll pay whatever it is, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000. Undertaker, when he sat down with Stone Cold, talked about, when he was trying to break into the business, paying $3,000 and then getting screwed out of most of his training. You know, you can find a lot of wrestlers who have stories like that. Braun Strowman got paid to drive down to Florida to go work for WWE. He got paid to drive down and train to become a professional wrestler. He's going to lecture other wrestlers about working hard to achieve their goals. This is not even a matter of, oh, well, there's that elitist WWE attitude of the WWE star, who, of course, they get paid really well. Look, I didn't see any other WWE stars agreeing with him or liking that post. Or if they did, if they do agree with him, they have enough sense to keep their mouth shut. I'd say the majority of those on the WWE roster or the NXT roster, they came from the independents. They know what that's like. They know about that whole struggle. The last thing any of them would do is take a post like that and twist it into something negative. How do you get something negative out of that post? Out of Evil Uno's post, I don't understand. I would bet anything that a lot of them saw what Braun posted and thought the exact same thing that I did and that a lot of you did, which is, what a dick. What a dick. He's trying to make his point by making his own story sound more dramatic than it really is. Now he's got himself a nice, big, fat 4-year contract. He just re-signed last year, I think, with the company. I'm sure he's worked very hard for it. And he's improved a lot since he started doing this. He doesn't have a lot of years under his belt. All things considered, for a big guy like this, Braun Strowman, he's taken to this whole wrestling thing pretty well. I don't doubt that he works hard. He got a nice contract out of it, a nice renewal. Good for him. But have a little fucking empathy for some of your fellow wrestlers instead of belittling them. As if that wasn't bad enough to read, Alberto El Patron was back in the news. He told a TV station in Mexico that he was in talks with WWE and he expects that he might return to the company as soon as this summer. If there's one thing WWE needs right now about as much as a deadly outbreak, it's the return of Alberto Del Rio. Raw on Monday night from an empty PC was a thumbs down show, according to 56% of you who voted on Twitter with more than 3,500 votes cast. It was literally a one match show, one live match with Rey Mysterio pinning the United States champion in a non-title match. I would hope that sets something up for WrestleMania. Otherwise, well, I mean, you know, champs are chumps. What else could I say? The highlight of the show was Edge's live promo in the ring. Edge had travel issues, according to Beth Phoenix, getting to Orlando. So he opted instead to drive from North Carolina to Orlando. 17 hours it took him to get to Raw for a segment that would have been as effective, if not, I think, more effective, from his own living room. Especially if he had his wife, Beth, sitting next to him on the couch. I think that would have been even better. He called Randy Orton an entitled brat who had everything handed to him. He revealed that before Randy RKO'd his wife, Beth was actually on Raw to retire him again. She didn't think it was fair for her husband to have to go out on TV and say those words again after he did 9 years ago. So she was going to do it for him, but Orton didn't let her finish. Orton had said that Edge helped pull him out of a dark hole many years ago. Well, Randy just did the same for him. He challenged him to a last man standing match at WrestleMania. I thought his delivery here was great, very intense, and it's one of the matches that I hope they tape from another location. They replayed the entire Men's Royal Rumble match from January as a way to kill time. The first time a full Royal Rumble match has aired on USA Network since the very first one in 1988. With commercials added to it, this took up almost 2 hours of this 3-hour show. It started around 20 after 8, and it didn't end until almost 10 p.m. And it held the ratings pretty well. But killing almost 2 hours of the show by showing a match from 2 months ago was a good way to get me to go do something else. When I came back, it was time for the contract signing with Undertaker and AJ Styles, which I thought was pretty lame. Outside of AJ doing some of his best promo work from the back, I thought AJ was great. He was shown on the Tron backstage with Anderson and Gallows. He called Undertaker over the hill. He said, "You don't see Michael Jordan inserting himself into the NBA Finals, or Peyton Manning or Brett Favre inserting themselves into the Super Bowl," which would be kind of cool. He said, "But it's WrestleMania season, so of course The Undertaker is going to insert himself into WrestleMania." He was pissed about Undertaker costing him 2 matches. And at WrestleMania, he said he wouldn't be able to hide. And then he cracked a joke about Undertaker not being able to run either. I laughed. Although Undertaker, he did march down to the ring faster than I've ever seen him move before in my life. He stormed down to the ring for this contract signing and flipped over the table. He flipped over the desk in the ring. Jerry Lawler ran for cover before they cut to a commercial. And that's when they came back and they resumed with all of this stuff and AJ's promo on the screen. So he didn't get a dead man entrance. There was no hat. There was no jacket. He looked closer to his old big evil persona than the dead man. But he needs to speak. See, the whole appeal with that is that he cuts his own promo on AJ as a regular person, not as the dead man. So we've got 2 more Raws to get that promo from The Undertaker. And I don't know. I mean, they're taping the next couple of Raws this week. I mean, I guess they're going to be live tomorrow, and then they're taping 2 on Tuesday. So if Undertaker has already flown home, unless they're going to film something from his house, maybe they'll do with him and Michelle McCool what I just suggested they should have done with Edge and Beth Phoenix. Maybe they'll interview Undertaker on his couch at home with Michelle McCool and their pet tiger. But AJ said that he was going to offer to pay for Undertaker's assisted living costs. Assisted living is probably the last place Undertaker wants to be right now with a deadly virus going around killing older people. AJ just signed the contract, and he sent Abbott and Costello out to the ring to deliver it to The Undertaker. They hesitated at first. Eventually, they resisted. They resisted. They ended up going out there, and of course, they got their asses kicked. Undertaker signed the contract. He stuffed it down Carl Anderson's throat, Million Dollar Man style. You know, Ted DiBiase introduced The Undertaker to WWE. How about that? some continuity there. Either that or I'm just looking way too deeply at this. It was 316 day, and the star of the show was Stone Cold Steve Austin, who entered to silence for the first time in his career. Even the ringmaster got more of a reaction than Stone Cold got here. He seemed like he was having a good time. He was laughing, he was smiling, he was drinking beer. They used Byron Saxton for comedy with him, but I thought Byron did a good job. I just thought the comedy itself was lame. They had Austin reading off cue cards. This was their big idea for him? This was their big backup idea for him? Who knows? Maybe this was the original plan. Austin reading lame comedy off of cue cards was their big idea for Stone Cold Steve Austin. You know what? Why not just have him out there to do commentary for some matches with the announcers? I think he would have been far more entertaining doing that, and then you could have had him get in the ring at the end and stun somebody and drink beer. Anyway, he invited Byron into the ring, handed him a beer, kicked him in the dick, gave him a stunner. Becky Lynch brought a cooler down to the ring and shared a beer with Stone Cold, and he dumped the beer on Byron, stunned him again to close out the show. After the show, they posted on YouTube what happened when the show was over. And after the show, Austin kicked Byron in the dick multiple times, gave him more stunners. Street Profits came out. Austin stunned both of them, too. I thought this segment was lame, but look, good for Byron. He probably got to live out a dream getting stunned by Stone Cold. And if people were able to watch Stone Cold and take their mind off the world for 10 or 15 minutes... then good for them. But the lamest Austin segment that you'll ever see. I guess they just had to work within the confines of what they had. But I still think you could have done a lot more with Stone Cold. Look, you could have Stone Cold going around. Grab the camera guy. Take the camera guy to the back. Let him go around and, you know, toast different people with his beers and, you know, get a tour of the gym at the PC. There's so many things you could have done with this guy, because Austin's a very entertaining guy. When you script lame comedy for him, though, man, that's just, that's not what you do with Stone Cold. SmackDown. SmackDown on Friday was neither good nor terrible. This show has no soul. It has no personality. It has no life. It merely exists. Like that doorknob I'm looking at right now, or that wall in front of me, with my acoustic panels here. I see a piece of lint on the floor. I'll have to vacuum that up in a second. It merely exists. It is present. It is there. That is my best definition for SmackDown now on most weeks. The best part of this entire show was whatever Sasha Banks was wearing. She looked like she killed a tiger on safari and decided to wear it. And don't tell The Undertaker, because according to him, if you save the tigers, you save the world. Which makes no sense. But that's okay. I'm all for saving the tigers. Having them kill the poachers. It does put a smile on my face. Every blue moon, I'll be on Twitter. Or social media somewhere, and I'll see a story about poachers in Africa who ended up being just ripped to shreds by the creatures that they're trying to kill. Few things in life bring me more joy than reading stories like that. I think that's great. Rob Gronkowski is hosting WrestleMania this year. Mojo Rawley introduced him at the top of the show. He danced to the ring. Their big idea for this big celebrity get was to have him shove King Corbin on his ass and make a match for WrestleMania between Baron Corbin and Elias. They turned Gronkowski heel with that move. At least to me they did. I guess people like Elias, but you bring in Rob Gronkowski and the first thing he does is make a match for WrestleMania. WrestleMania between Baron Corbin and Elias. Really? That's a rough start there for Rob Gronkowski. I am enjoying the Daniel Bryan Drew Gulak team. The banter between the two of them. They beat Cesaro and Shinsuke Nakamura. After the match, they're all in the back. And Sami Zayn and Shinsuke and Cesaro walk up to Bryan and Gulak, and they were furious about the loss. And he was mocking, Sami was. He was mocking Drew Gulak. Got in his face. And Daniel Bryan challenged Sami Zayn to an Intercontinental Championship match at WrestleMania. That would also include Drew Gulak, and Zayn, he agreed, only if Gulak can beat Nakamura next week on SmackDown. So let's assume that happens. We're going to get a triple threat at WrestleMania with Bryan, Gulak, and Sami Zayn. Sounds good to me. I just assumed they were going to, you know, have Braun chasing Zayn for weeks on TV trying to kill him, and then he would catch him, and he would kill him and get the IC belt back at WrestleMania. This is even better. And I wouldn't change the title, by the way. I would keep that championship on Sami for the foreseeable future. Daniel Bryan, speaking of him, he says that he's probably done as a full-time performer when his contract is over. On the Bella Twins podcast, he said WWE is giving him 6 weeks off for paternity leave after Brie gives birth, which, as he pointed out, very few companies in the U.S. do that. They not a lot of companies give men paternity leave, but WWE has been great. They're going to give him 6 weeks off. Brie is due in August, and he said that his contract, he didn't give a date, but he said that his contract is up not long after that, which reads to me like, I mean, let's say she gives birth in August, he gets 6 weeks off. He's saying his contract is up not long after. That would probably be the end of the year. I mean, unless it's up right after WrestleMania next year. But that sounds to me like at the end of 2020, you know, his contract could be expired. And I wonder, I was thinking about this, if they do end up shutting down operations because of everything that's going on, if it gets to that point where WWE has to totally shut down, just like all the other sports leagues have had to shut down, if that would, in effect, I would think it would, freeze everybody's contract, which would include Daniel Bryan, which would include the Revival, but that would include Daniel Bryan's, so that if he wanted to leave, they wouldn't let him. However long the company is shut down for and frozen and not running events or doing any kind of TV, if it got to that point, you know, I would imagine that they would argue that everyone's contract is hereby frozen. You know, now he said that he still expects to wrestle, maybe only once a month or so. I listened to what he said. I didn't just read it. I dared to load up the Bellas podcast. Thankfully, I had a timestamp for Daniel's thing. I didn't have to sit through too much of the Bella Twins podcast. But I heard the part where he was talking about this. I listened to what he was saying, the way he was saying it. I don't think he's going anywhere. Any hope that maybe he'll leave and, you know, if he thinks this really is the end of his career, maybe he's got a bucket list of opponents he'd like to wrestle and he's going to travel the world and he's going to wrestle in New Japan. He'll wrestle in AEW. He'll wrestle here. He'll go on the independents. He'll go to Mexico. Maybe he's got a bucket list that we're not aware of, but when you listen to him speak, it sounds to me like just mentally he's done with pro wrestling. You know, he was satisfied that he was able to come back and he's glad that he can wrestle and he's cleared and he wants to still wrestle maybe once a month or every other month, but it sounds to me like he's just ready to settle down and be a dad. He's going to have two kids. And if WWE is paying him well and they're giving him paternity leave and they're working with him and making things as comfortable for him as possible and being very accommodating to him and his family, why leave? Why leave? There's no reason for him to go anywhere. So I don't think he is. Look, if he didn't leave WWE before, he ain't leaving WWE now. That's what I would leave people with. If anybody's got any hope that Daniel Bryan is going to leave this time and go work on all these other places, almost like a Daniel Bryan retirement tour kind of thing, he's not going anywhere. That's what I'm getting out of this. Paige, she was there. I talked about the six-pack challenge stuff earlier. She was there via Skype. Apparently this was pre-recorded, so Bayley and Sasha were out there talking to a tape. Or an MP4, would it be? Am I dating myself by saying tape? I mean, I'm not that old, but I'm old enough to be from that era, I guess, of tapes and VCRs, right? I still think of things in terms of tape. I'm still scarred by the time that my evil VCR ate my SummerSlam 91 tape. I used to watch that all the time. Would watch the Bret Hart Mr. Perfect match. Would watch the Boss Man Mountie Jailhouse match. And then one day, the VCR just ate it. It was devastating. I tried to pull the tape out. It's all mangled. I actually had to go online. What was the guy's name? Was it John McAdam? John McAdam or Sean McAdam? Somebody like that. They had a tape trading website. I wasn't even trading. I bought a homemade recorded version of SummerSlam 91 to replace the copy that the evil VCR ate. It was a traumatic experience for me. So believe me, nobody is more happy that we are out of the tape era than I am. There she was up on the screen. There was Paige, and apparently now she has the power to make matches. I didn't know that she was still the general manager of SmackDown. But there she was, and telling Bayley that she's going to wrestle Sasha and Lacey and Tamina and all these people for the championship. But again, it doesn't need to be a six-pack challenge. I'm sure they're going to go the very subtle route with this. Sasha kind of flashed a smirk at the end of this, and Bayley walked out, and she was very upset. And maybe they're playing the long game here, and you know they're just going to set things up for it. Maybe Sasha will beat Bayley in the middle of the match at WrestleMania if it's an elimination match. Maybe they're going to put the championship on Tamina, just to fuck with us. Imagine Tamina, the new SmackDown Women's Champion. I would put nothing past these people. We got a replay of the John Cena-Bray Wyatt match from WrestleMania 30. That finish is every bit as upsetting as it was 6 years ago. So that killed some time for them here on the show. Look, at least they're delving into the backstory. Obviously, were it not for everything going on, we would have not had the entire match replayed. Plus, they're going to replay the entire thing again tonight on ESPN, since they're showing WrestleMania 30. So it all plays into the story. But I would suspect we're going to get more of this in the weeks to come, just to kill time, especially on Monday nights. They got 3 hours to kill. We had comedy with Miz and Morrison. I know some people like this. I really just wasn't a fan. I did laugh. I will say this. I didn't laugh at the actual comedy that they did, but when they wrestled Heavy Machinery, there was one part of the match where Miz was taunting Otis by telling him that Tucke was feeling yucke. And I did laugh at that. Tucke is feeling yucke. I thought that was funny. There's no accounting for my sense of humor. Some things I laugh at, some things I don't. And Miz and Morrison did end up beating Heavy Machinery by DQ. Dolph Ziggler came out and Otis snapped. He was beating up on Dolph. He took a chair and Tucker tried to talk him out of it. And he hit Miz and Morrison with the chairs and got them DQ'd. He was like a wild boar. And Tucker had to console him and calm him down. So that when the day comes that Otis gets his hands on Dolph in the ring, he's going to tear this guy to shreds. But there was no Mandy Rose here. No Mandy Rose on this show. And then we had the contract signing with Bill Goldberg and Roman Reigns for their Universal Championship match at WrestleMania. And Roman talked about all the legends that he's defeated. He said Goldberg wouldn't be any different than them. And Cole brought up a tweet that Roman Reigns posted back in January. And at the very end of the tweet, it was some fan asking him, why do you have that pad when you would come out and make your entrance on SmackDown each week? If you notice, they put a pad down where Roman puts his fist, and he was basically explaining, well, I don't want to break my fist. So when I do the fist thing on the ground, they put a pad. And then he took a jab at Goldberg headbutting locker room doors. Michael Cole asked him, well, why would you take that jab? And Roman's answer was, why not? Then he called Goldberg a little bitch bulldog, which was a jab at Goldberg playing for the Georgia Bulldogs in college. Roman played football for Georgia Tech. Nobody outside the state of Georgia gives a shit about any of that. Roman said that he was holding his title that he never earned. He signed the contract. Is that all Roman Reigns knows how to do? Is call people a bitch? When he's cutting a promo on them? Is that like his big applause line? He called John Cena a fake bitch. He called Brock Lesnar a bitch. He called Baron Corbin. He told him that he was going to make him his bitch. And here he called Goldberg a little bitch bulldog. It's like his favorite word to use. That's his go-to line, I guess, to get a reaction. To call people a bitch. Goldberg said, listen, punk. I've been destroying steel doors across the... or headbutting steel doors across the globe with that headbutt, and come WrestleMania, you're going to be the next victim. And Goldberg signed the contract, and he flipped over the table. They went nose to nose, and I listened to the camera people in their headset yelling commands over and over again until they went off the air. The intensity was there. Look, I'll say this about Goldberg. Goldberg and Roman, right? Two big guys. nose to nose, face to face, right? Okay, great. Goldberg is great when it comes to him cutting a promo or trash talking somebody. He still got it, right? He can cut promos better than most in the company, and he's got that intensity about him. So the stare down was fine. As a contract signing and as a back and forth on the microphone, this really wasn't that great. This really was nothing special. This did nothing to get me any more interested in their match at WrestleMania. And if they're going to position this as the Georgia Tech guy against the University of Georgia guy, the Georgia Bulldogs, and whatever the team is that Roman played for, I don't give a fuck. I don't give a shit about college football. I don't give a shit what teams they played for. Who cares? Outside of the state of Georgia, who gives a shit? So, as far as the trash talking is concerned, they got to ratchet things up in the next few weeks to, you know, get people, I think, to really take notice of them and get them really excited about the match. Or maybe you already are excited. Maybe they could just sell it off the Battle of the Spears. Who has the better spear? Is it Roman Reigns? Is it Goldberg? Is it Brittany? I don't know. We're going to find out. We're going to find out at WrestleMania. Maybe that's the story. But I don't care about their college. Maybe Jim Ross does. I don't care about their college football background. That does not get me any more interested in this match. Now, I did see Bret Hart. Bret the Hitman Hart was on the Broken Skull Sessions with Stone Cold Steve Austin. I've enjoyed these interviews. He's done a whole bunch of them by now. The Undertaker one is one of the best that he's done, just because Undertaker doesn't do very many of those types of interviews. And Undertaker's been around forever. You know, I feel like in this company, he's been around longer than pretty much everybody. And his memory is still pretty good. You know, some guys will do interviews and they don't remember shit. I'll listen to, like, Eric Bischoff give an interview every now and then. The guy is so full of shit. It's obvious that he doesn't remember a whole lot of what was going on back then. Some guys just don't remember. Or they have terrible memories. Undertaker seemed like he's got all of his faculties. He remembers all the stories, despite all the drinking and the partying and all the stuff he's been through over the years. So that was a very compelling interview to me. The interview with Big Show, I think Big Show gives a great interview. I thought the Big Show interview was great. This one was no different. This was Bret being Bret. The most Bret Hart thing you could imagine is how they started the interview. He was asking Bret about a vacation that he had just taken. They just came back, I guess, him and his wife from Hawaii. And he was complaining. He was complaining because I guess it rained. So he asked him about his Hawaiian vacation. His first thing was to complain about his vacation to Hawaii. And I thought, that's Bret Hart. What can I say? That's the Hitman. So the first thing Austin wanted to start with, I guess it's good they got it out of the way, but they spent 15 or 20 minutes on this, was what else? The Montreal Screwjob. I mean, look, I guess you can't do a sit-down interview with Bret and not at least broach the subject. But my God, with this Montreal, even Dark Side of the Ring on Vice last year did a whole episode on Montreal. And it was probably the weakest or one of the weakest of the bunch. Not because the story isn't compelling if you've never heard it before, but just when you've heard it a gazillion times. It's like, come on now. So they dove right into Montreal. And, you know, Bret's been always fairly consistent in the story that he's told about why this all happened. When you think back to it, why did this even happen in the first place? Was it just that Bret was a mark for himself and didn't want a job? You know, was that really the answer to all of this? No. It all goes back. There was an event in San Jose. And that was when Bret found out that he was going to work with Sean at Survivor Series in Montreal. And Sean had thanked Bret for the match that, you know, that took place that night. I guess Sean was the referee in San Jose for Bret's match against whoever it was. Might have been Undertaker. And Bret said to Sean, he goes, look, you know, I know this was only a few weeks after they had their hair-pulling fight backstage like a bunch of girls back in June. I think it was June of 97. And so this was a few months earlier. These guys literally were ripping each other's hair out of their heads and had to be broken apart. So Bret said, look, I know that we're going to be working in Montreal. And I just wanted you to know that I'm willing to put you over as a way to kind of broker a peace here. It's like, I'm willing to put you over, you know, anytime. And he was being very magnanimous. This is Bret's version of events. I've never heard Sean dispute this before, but this has always been Bret's version of how this went down. It's traced back to this day in San Jose. He says this to Sean, and Sean says, well, I appreciate that, but I just want you to know that I'm not willing to do the same for you. And he walked away. And that's what kicked this whole thing off. It was the idea that in his mind, in Brett's mind, I'm willing to put you over. I'm willing to let bygones be bygones. Let's put the past behind us. Let's be pros here. I'm willing to do the right thing. I'm willing to put you over. And the fact that Sean said, well, I appreciate that, but just so you know, I'm not willing to do the same for you. So the next day is when Vince told Brett that, hey, Sean's going to win the championship. He's going to beat you at Survivor Series. And Brett said, well, wait a minute. He goes, no, 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 no. First of all, he did bring up the whole 60 days of creative control in the final 60 days of his contract. And look, if it's in his contract, it's in his contract. Don't blame Brett for that. Blame Vince McMahon for putting in the damn contract. That's why you don't give guys 60 days, 90 days, 100 days, permanent creative control. I mean, WCW gave it to Hogan. Vince McMahon wouldn't give it to Hogan. But it was an honor thing with Brett. He goes, if this guy's not willing to put me over, then you know what? Fuck him. I'm not willing to do the same for him if he's not going to do it for me. Why should this only come from one side? So he got into that whole story, and Austin said that, you know, Vince was basically trading you in, it sounds like, for a younger horse. And Brett says, look, I offered to drop the title to anybody else. I even offered to drop it to Sean on Raw the night after Survivor Series. But he said Sean had to be willing to put me over before I put him over. I guess he had already put him over at WrestleMania 12. They were going to wrestle at WrestleMania 13 at one point. That didn't happen with Sean's wonky knee. He said Sean has to be willing to put me over or put me over before I do the same for him. And that's where we were. And then at that point, things just went south. We all know how it ended up. And they showed footage from the match in Montreal, and they, you know, Austin thought they were having a great match. They were having this great 15, 16, 17 minute match up until what ended up happening. Brett told the story again of seeing Earl Hebner in Detroit in the lead up to the match. This might have been the night before. And, you know, Brett claims he was worried about there being some kind of a screw job. And Earl swore on his kid's life. He said, I would never, ever do anything like that to you. If I'm the referee for your match, I swear on the life of my children, I would never do anything to screw you over like that. And Earl had been with the company for ages, and he had refereed a lot of Brett's matches, and Brett trusted him. He said, okay, I feel at ease now. Now, he wasn't sure that Earl Hebner was going to be the referee for the match. He was hoping, after hearing that Earl would be the ref. And then he came to find out the next day that, in fact, Earl had been assigned to the match. And he kind of breathed a sigh of relief because he trusted Earl Hebner. The guy swore on his children's lives. I mean, my God. How can I not trust somebody like that? Of course, Earl Hebner was put in an impossible spot because as he's about to go out there, he gets pulled aside and said, listen, we need you to do this. And that's it. And I don't know if they outright told him that if you don't do it, you're going to be fired. But in his mind, he's probably thinking, well, I could lose my job. I got to do what I'm told. I got to make money. I'm a referee. I'm a lot more expendable than Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels would be. And Bret doesn't hold any animosity towards Earl. He says, if I were in his shoes, I don't know, maybe I would have done the same thing that Earl did. You know, he can't be sure. And then he got into the locker room situation. Undertaker didn't wrestle that night. If you remember, Undertaker didn't have a match at Survivor Series, but he was there. He was in the back and he was pissed. He was really upset. And I kind of wish that Austin would have brought this up. Or did he bring it up? I don't think he did during the Broken Skull interview he did with Undertaker. I don't know. I don't remember this coming up or not. I know it came up in the Michael Landsberg interview. Actually, no, it didn't. I take that back. That was WrestleMania 14. That was a different incident with Shawn Michaels when Undertaker was taping up his fists. So I would love to hear from the Undertaker's mouth what he remembers. Since his memory is so good, I'd love to know what he remembers from that night. But according to Brett, you know, and Austin, who was there as well, you know, Undertaker was, he was incensed. He was saying, fuck it. He was kicking over garbage cans. He told Vince, you got to make this right. You got to go apologize to Brett. You got to go face the man face to face. Because Vince had locked himself in his office. And so eventually they did, have a meeting of the minds, shall we say, in Brett's locker room. And Brett's walking around naked. He did briefly think about attacking Vince, jumping him basically while he was naked, and they had a nice laugh about that. He said, "What a visual that would have been." He goes, "I thought better of that. I didn't want to jump on Vince buck naked." But he was going to go take a shower. He said, "Listen, if you're still here when I get out, I'm going to knock you out." And when he came out of that shower, there was Vince. And he described the punch. He said it was more of an uppercut. It wasn't like a sucker punch or an overhand punch. It was an uppercut. And it lifted Vince off the ground, and Vince, you know, fell to the ground. Now, he didn't get into the other details that had been told about what happened in the big pull-apart. Shane McMahon was there. Somebody stepped on Vince's ankle. It might have been Briscoe or somebody by accident. I don't know if it broke Vince's ankle or just injured it, but somebody stepped on Vince's ankle. British Bulldog had his knee brace off when all of this was going down, and he ended up, I think, twisting or hyperextending his already injured knee. So a lot of people that got injured, not just Vince. Vince got punched in the face, but a lot of people got hurt. A lot of egos got hurt. Sean, of course, denied the whole thing. He was crying, head in his hands. And Brett shook his hand. Brett believed him, or maybe he didn't, but he took Sean at his word. He put his hand out to shake Sean's hand, to thank him for the match. "I trust that you didn't know about this. You had nothing to do with this." And he put his hand out to shake Sean's hand for the match that they just had. I will always be pissed that Brett sent the documentary crew out of that locker room. Because he said he had told he wishes that he had told the guy to keep recording at least part of it. But when Vince and everybody came into the locker, you could see it in the documentary Wrestling with Shadows. He basically said, "Turn the camera off." But that's what you should. That's what you would have wanted to get on camera, though. I would have just told the guy, "Hey, pretend the camera's off. Go hang back in the corner of the room." Imagine if we got all of that on tape. Now, maybe I don't need to see buck naked Bret Hart walking around. You could always blur that out. But man, imagine if this whole—it's like it's this big legend that's been built up of this fight and this knockout punch over the years. And I would have loved to have gotten that on video. We do have Vince McMahon on video limping, stumbling out of the locker room, and Briscoe and the people with him saying, "Just keep your head down." The camera was in the hallway filming that when Vince walked out. You could see, I'm assuming Vince is limping because somebody stepped on his fucking ankle. So again, we've all heard this story before. It is fascinating though, to visualize what that locker room confrontation looked like and the Undertaker being pissed and everything. And, anyway, so that was the whole, Montreal thing. So then they talked about WCW and how WCW didn't know what to do with Brett. And, Brett said, "Look, I mean, I was the hottest guy in wrestling. I had beaten the Undertaker. I was the champion." Right? He said, "I'd beaten you," as in Austin. "I'd beaten Undertaker at SummerSlam. I was the champion. I didn't really lose to Shawn. There was all this controversy around me, and WCW got me. They brought me in, and they did not know what to do with me." They had Bret Hart refereeing a match. That was really his first appearance in WCW as a fucking referee. And he said, "You know, I should have been wrestling Hulk Hogan. I should have had Hulk Hogan in the sharpshooter." Now, WCW was doing the Hulk Hogan Sting program at that time, heading into Starrcade. You can't disrupt that. I mean, that was built up for like a year and a half. I understand what Brett is saying. Do you put Brett on ice and hold him until January and risk, you know, kind of all the momentum and all the controversy around him dying down? Or do you bring him and put him on TV right away and strike while the iron is hot? Well, if you do that, what do you do with him? Because Hogan is already occupied with Sting. I just think they could have come up with something a little bit better than just having him be a referee. But yeah, they should have absolutely capitalized on that and done a lot more with Brett up front than they did. And, you know, he really was. He was the hottest name. He was the most talked about name in wrestling for that period of a month or two after Montreal. And they squandered that. Now, one of the key points of the interview that I loved was just listening to Brett and Austin go back and forth talking about, you know, their not just their matches together, but what makes a great match. I could listen to Brett talk all day about that kind of stuff. He was talking about the difference in his mind between a great match and a classic match. Because a classic match is a match that people are going to talk about years later. It's not a match where, wow, those two went out and had a great match, and then maybe in a month or a few weeks you forget about it. It's a match that lasts a lifetime. And when I think about Brett's career, and one of the reasons why he's my favorite of all time, is he has as long of a list, if not longer, than practically anybody in the history of WWE when it comes to classic matches. The only person I could think of who maybe has a longer list, and a lot of that has to do with just the fact that his career ended up being a lot longer than Brett. Brett had to retire. Shawn Michaels had this whole second career, this whole comeback when he came back from all of his demons and the back surgery and everything else. It was like Shawn Michaels pre and post back surgery, the tale of two careers. Brett didn't have that chance. Imagine if Brett had even five more years and could wrestle Kurt Angle and all these different people, Brock Lesnar in WWE. Imagine the other classic matches he could have put together. You know, the classic matches that I think of when I think of Brett, it's not so much the Hart Foundation matches. I think those are great matches. The 2 out of 3 falls against Demolition at SummerSlam, and the matches that the Hart, I guess you could say the matches that the Hart Foundation had in the mid-80s with the Bulldogs. I can't think of one specific match, but they had a whole series of classic matches against each other. But when I think of Brett's career and I think of the classic matches that he has had, I think of the two matches on pay-per-view that he had with Kurt Hennig, you know, the Mr. Perfect match at SummerSlam, and then the rematch at the King of the Ring in 93, which was even better, in my opinion, than the SummerSlam match. Him and the Bulldog headlining Wembley Stadium in front of 80,000 people at SummerSlam. Him and Owen, both matches they had in 94, WrestleMania 10, and the cage match later that year at SummerSlam. The matches he had with Austin, specifically the WrestleMania 13 match, which is one of the best matches in the history of that company. The matches he had with Shawn, I don't know that he ever had that one classic match with Shawn Michaels. I mean, some people would say the Iron Man match. I'm not as big of a fan of that as a lot of other people are. But yeah, some people would throw the Iron Man match at WrestleMania on that list. You know, and there's others I'm sure I'm not thinking of. I'm thinking now even in terms of TV matches. You know, the Raw match in 94 with the 1-2-3 kid. He had another match with Bulldog, the one in Hershey at that In Your House pay-per-view. The body of work that Brett put together was tremendous. You know, and the stories that... And I keep thinking to the King of the Ring pay-per-view in 93. Each match was different. Each match was a different opponent. Each match told its own story. The opening match with Razor Ramon, the stomping on the fingers, injuring the fingers, carrying that over into the match with Perfect, carrying those injuries, you know, into the final match with Bam Bam Bigelow, the biggest opponent, you know, of the night for him. It's one of the reasons why that's one of my all-time favorite pay-per-views. It wasn't just the matches, it was... You know, the story that Brett tried to tell throughout all three of the matches that he had that night. And then they capped it off with Jerry Lawler showing up and beating the hell out of him. But that's the difference in his view between a great match and a classic match. How many matches are there going to be that people are going to still be talking about 10, 15, 20, 25 years later? Brett has got as many as anybody. And that's why he is... one of the best that the company has ever had, despite what Jake Roberts would say. I know Jake the Snake Roberts was mouthing off on a podcast this week about Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels both being two of the worst champions in the history of WWE. He's looking at it from the perspective of how many asses did they put in the seats. He's looking at it, I don't want to say purely, because I'm sure he's inferring that they were just very small. And so which is a funny view to take when you think about it. I mean, he signed with AEW, which is a company that has an awful lot of smaller wrestlers. I wonder what those guys think of Jake's comments. But I think he's coming at it in that podcast he did from the perspective of they don't compare to Hogan, they don't compare to Austin and people like that because business was bad or business was down. And it was. Business would have been a lot worse had Brett not been the champion and gotten over the way he did, because Brett was very popular. But was Brett Hulk Hogan 1986 popular? Was Brett Steve Austin 1998 popular? No. Not in this country, maybe elsewhere. For whatever reason, they loved him in Germany and Italy and all these other countries. Canada, obviously. So yeah, if you're going to compare it to those guys, then no. business was not the same. The reactions were not the same. There's very few people who were up in that rarefied air that Hogan and Austin and maybe Rock, maybe put Rock on that list. That's rarefied air. Not many people are up there. Brett and Sean, they're one tier below that. And I say that as a Brett fan. They're not all on the same level. They're one level below. So I'm not going to tear apart with Jake. I disagree with Jake when he says that they were two of the worst champions in history. Because there is evidence that, you know, business would have been far worse at that time in 94 if Brett wasn't on top as the champion. Now, there's a reason why they went with him instead of Lex Luger. You know, Lex Luger looked like $1 million. He might have been physically more impressive than Bret Hart, but you think the company was doing poorly in 94, they would have gone to shit if Lex Luger was the champion. Shawn Michaels, 96. Yeah, business wasn't great, but from what I remember, house show business with Shawn as champion was actually pretty strong. Maybe TV ratings weren't, but you know, it's not as though that the buildings were mostly empty when he was the champion, so I don't even know that that's really totally fair of him to say that. But he's an old school guy, and he probably doesn't, you know, he looks at things a certain way. It's hard to break that. You know, he came up in the land of the Giants. He made another comment Jake did during that podcast interview where he was talking about, I don't know if it was Brett or Sean or somebody else, but, you know, he was talking about somebody and, you know, imagine putting them in the ring with Andre. He's like, oh, my point's been made. You know, would you be able to buy into the fact that they could ever stand toe-to-toe with Andre the Giant? Andre the Giant was the relic of a different era. You know, Andre the Giant, in any other era, yeah, he would have been a big guy. But wrestling changes. That was the era of the Giants. So Andre could go in there with a lot of other people who were similar in size to him. You know, Big John Studd and Bundy and Hogan. Hogan was a big guy. Even Jake. Jake's a big guy. Jake's a big, tall guy. But it was just a different time. If you're gonna make that comparison, I mean, my God, who on the AEW roster could stand up to Andre the Giant? Are we really basing everything around who would look believable in the ring with Andre the Giant? Is that what we're doing now? It's just a different time. But Austin and Brett talked about their match at Survivor Series in 96. Brett called it a 4-star match. They both seemed to agree it was not their best match. It was definitely not as good or as classic as their match at WrestleMania. But it's a match that gets overlooked because everybody tends to talk about the submission match at WrestleMania 13. But the Survivor Series 96 match, which was Brett's comeback match at MSG, was actually very good. Austin takes great pride in blowing up Brett. They showed Brett at the very end of the match kind of breathing heavily, and I think he said the word fuck, if I remember. And Austin was laughing gleefully. He goes, I blew you up. I take great pride in that. They did talk about the WrestleMania 13 match, one of the greatest matches in really the history of that entire company. Forget WrestleMania. And that was the big match with the double turn. And Brett was not convinced that this was the right thing to do. He was very worried about turning heel. And Vince said, oh, it's going to work. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. We're going to turn you heel. You're going to be a babyface to all the foreigners, but you're going to be a heel here in the U.S. And Brett was more concerned about losing all the merch money. You know, as a babyface, people buy your t-shirts, they buy your gear, your glasses, all your shit. And he's like, you're going to turn me heel. Nobody's going to buy my stuff. My paycheck's going to go down. And what really convinced him was Vince put together a list. He showed Brett a list of 5 guys that he would be working with if he was a babyface and 5 guys that he would be working with if he was a heel. He was far more impressed by the list of baby faces that he would be working with as a heel, as opposed to, and he name-dropped Vader. You know, and Austin was quick to say, you know, Leon passed away, God rest his soul and all that, but Brett said, you know, he was like a teddy bear, but you didn't want to be in the ring with him because he would beat the fuck out of you, you know? So he's looking at these lists and he's saying, well, if I'm a baby face, I'd have to work with Vader. He goes, maybe I'll turn heel. I like this list of opponents as a heel a lot better. Because then he would get to work with people like Austin. He'd get to work with Undertaker and, you know, people like that that he liked to work with. So, Austin was sitting at home with a knee injury. He didn't even know it was going to be a submission match. He found out about it like all of us did. He was watching on TV because he had tweaked his knee a few weeks earlier. Now he's sitting on the couch going, wait a minute, what the fuck? A submission match? I'm not a submission wrestler. I got no submission holds. I guess outside of maybe the million-dollar dream. He goes, I got no submission holds. I'm a brawler. So he wasn't very happy about that. And they had a lot of praise for Ken Shamrock. He was sort of the enforcer. They got permission to brawl into the crowd largely because Shamrock was going to be there to watch their back. So if anybody got out of line, you've got Ken Shamrock, this guy from the Ultimate Fighting World, who's going to put this person in their place if they try to interfere in this match. So they thought Shamrock did a great job, and Brett was very adamant. He goes, submission matches are hard to do. He goes, he said he had a submission match that was one of the worst matches he ever had, if not the worst match that he ever had, with Bob Backlund. That was a little bit different. That was not a submission match, it was an I Quit match. They did have the submission match was at Survivor Series, which was a few months earlier. That's when Backlund won the WWF title. But he called the match with Backlund at WrestleMania 11 the worst match of his career. And it was. that match sucked. He said, no offense to Bob. Because he and Bob Backlund, even the Survivor Series 94 match where he lost the championship, told a story, Owen on the outside pleading with his parents, throw in the towel, please, he's crying. But in the summer of 94... it was a July 94 episode of WWF Superstars, and I really wish they would get off their ass and upload these other years of Superstars. Right now they only have 1992, which is great, but I wish they would put up the other years as well. They had a tremendous match on TV. That was the night that Bob snapped. Backlund lost, and he snapped, and we got the birth of Crazy Bob. So the two of them actually had a tremendous match together in 94 on TV. But that match at WrestleMania 11 was the shit. So I got to agree with Brett. And Brett made it very clear. He said submission matches suck. You know, he kept talking about his match with Austin at WrestleMania. It was meant to be more of like a high school fight. That's how he pictured it in his head. He says, you know, he wanted it to kind of look real and feel real and, you know, nice and stiff. And he said the nut shot that Austin at one point gave Brett, he gave Brett a kick right in the crotch in the corner. And Brett said, even the ball shot that you gave me, that was great. It wasn't one of those ones that Ric Flair gives. Any chance to take a little dig at Ric Flair? Bret Hart does not like Ric Flair. And the comments that Brett would make about Flair, that goes all the way back to the early 90s when they were in two different companies. They do not like each other. At least Brett doesn't have much love for the Nature Boy. But they basically did a whole analysis of their match at WrestleMania, and I love the way they splice in footage of the matches on these Austin podcasts, so they're sitting there watching the match along and commenting on it. That's one of the aspects of the show that I love when they do that. So they talked about that whole thing, and you know, they talked about how losing a match, you can lose, and it can still make your entire career. Brett felt that he was a made man by losing to the Bulldog at SummerSlam in 92. Austin says, look, I lost both matches to you. I lost at Survivor Series 96, and I lost at WrestleMania 13, and I still got over. He says, I never won a match against you. Stone Cold never won a match, unless it was maybe like a DQ or something. He never won a match against Bret Hart. He never pinned him. He never made him submit. He never really beat Bret Hart, and he's not mad about it because how could he be mad? Those two matches made his career. It launched him to another level. So that's an example of how even losing can really make somebody. You don't always have to win. They talked about the match with Austin and Owen at SummerSlam in 97 and what, you know, went wrong there. And he had to change his style, Austin did, when it was over because he couldn't do a lot of the fancy stuff, technical stuff anymore. He became more of a brawler. And so they talked a little bit about Owen, and obviously Brett would love to see him in the Hall of Fame. They didn't, you know, dwell on it too much because what is there to dwell on? I mean, we all know why he's not in the Hall of Fame. I don't see that changing anytime soon. They talked about the 10-man tag at Canadian Stampede in July of 97. Brett is the only surviving member of that team, Team Canada. So when you go back and watch the match, it's a great match, but when you see the entrances and Brian Pillman comes out and Jim Neidhart comes out and British Bulldog comes out, Owen Hart comes out, and then here comes the sole survivor. Here comes Bret Hart. All the loss in that family. It's just unbelievable. It's like, I'd say second only to the Von Erichs. Second only to the Von Erichs when it comes to family tragedies in wrestling. I mean, I guess you could say Benoit. I'm looking at it in terms of, like, quote, wrestling families. But yeah, Benoit would actually be at the very top of the list. But you think about the Von Erichs and you think about the Hart family and all the extended members of the Hart family and how many are gone. Bret took great pride in the fact that he never injured anyone. He could be stiff enough to make things look real and to make things look believable, but he was taught by guys in Japan, you know, how to make things look really brutal without actually hurting anybody. And that led into the discussion about Bill Goldberg, which to me, in a lot of ways, was the highlight of this whole. He just went off on Goldberg. He went off on Goldberg. He's clearly very annoyed that Goldberg is in the Hall of Fame. Everybody that he worked with, he said he was just totally unprofessional and dangerous. Kurt Hennig used to do matches with Goldberg and be all banged up when they were over. He told Goldberg before their match at Starrcade, which, you know, really led to the end of Bret's career, he said, look, don't hurt me. Don't go crazy and don't hurt me. Now, what's kind of weird about this is that I've heard Bret do interviews before where he's almost like forgiven Goldberg. And he said, bro, Goldberg was, he was a nice guy. He just, you know, it's just one of those things that happened. In his own book, Bret called Goldberg a good man who didn't know his own brute strength. And he and Goldberg have reunited over the years at, like, autograph signings and stuff. And I thought things were cool now between the two of them. I guess Goldberg has given interviews before where he's also had a change in tune. And he's sort of disavowed any responsibility, and Bret should have known that it was coming and all that kind of stuff. But Bret's done the same thing where he'll say good things about Goldberg in one breath, but then here, and in a lot of the more recent interviews that he's done, he just goes off on Goldberg and says, I can't believe they put him in the Hall of Fame for hurting as many wrestlers as he hurt. You know, and usually without any consequence, he said. He would go back and in the locker room and get a pat on the back for how good of a job he did, and you know, meanwhile, you're scraping his opponent up off the mat. So he did not mince words here in this interview when it came to Bill Goldberg. And that's one of the things I like about Bret is that, yes, sometimes he comes across as being very whiny and just overly complaining about stuff. He does. He does. And he has a very high opinion of himself and a very high opinion of his own work, which I think is well-deserved. His body of work speaks for itself. But the thing I like about Bret is when he does an interview like this, he's not going to sugarcoat shit. He's not going to come on and toe the company line. He's not going to come on and say good things just because he doesn't want to get on the bad side of Vince McMahon and WWE and not be invited back to do stuff like this. He doesn't give a shit. He doesn't need any of this. He'd be perfectly content to just, you know, live his life with his new wife and do what he does. He doesn't need any of this. So when he does an interview, he doesn't hold back. He doesn't hold back. He gives his opinion for what it is. If you don't like it, tough shit. That's what I like and respect about Bret Hart. So if you missed the interview, I did go through a lot of the key stuff. That's not everything. Always better to hear it in Bret's words, of course. If you haven't seen it, you got time to kill, which of course everybody now has time to kill, because what the hell else are we supposed to do? We can't go anywhere. You can go on the network. I would say it's worth a watch. All of these interviews that Austin has done so far have been very good. I don't know who he's interviewing next. If I think, who would I like to see sit down with Stone Cold in an interview like this? I would say Brock Lesnar, and I know he's already interviewed Lesnar. He interviewed Lesnar on the Stone Cold podcast on the network. It's basically the same thing, just with a different name. He also interviewed Big Show, but I love the new Big Show interview. Maybe he can get Brock back in the studio with him, and he can ask Brock other questions that they didn't talk about the first time. If he could get Brock to open up, I think Brock would be a fascinating guy for him to sit down with the second time. Vince McMahon, why not sit down with him a second time? They only scratched the surface of what they could talk about. There's been so many new things that have happened in the year since they did their interview. I'd love to see Vince McMahon sit down and do another two-hour interview with Steve Austin. The one I'd really like to see also, him get, and it's just a matter of timing, I think, is The Rock. I'd love to see Stone Cold and The Rock just sitting back, drinking tequila and beer, and just shooting the shit for 2 hours talking about wrestling and life and what it was like to work together and the Attitude Era and all that stuff. I think that would be great. I did watch the NXT show from Wednesday. I really don't have much to say about it. There were no live matches. It was Triple H and Tom Phillips in studio recording wraparounds, just talking about the Johnny Gargano, Tommaso Ciampa rivalry, Finn Balor and Walter, Charlotte Flair and Rhea Ripley. They spent the entire first hour showing highlights of the relationship between Tommaso Ciampa and Johnny Gargano and how they came together and came to NXT and DIY and Ciampa turning on him and then their feud and then coming back together. It was really well done. It was a very detailed, you know, documented history between the two. If they were building to a big takeover match or a big pay-per-view match between them, this is the kind of thing that you would show, you know, the weekend before or something as like a special to get people really excited. The problem is we have no idea when we're going to see the blow-off now between Tommaso Ciampa and Johnny Gargano. And it's the same thing when Ciampa got hurt. We didn't get it in New York last year. This thing is cursed. Before it was an injury, now it's a plague. We don't know when we're going to get this match. Takeover has been canceled. Are they just going to do the match on TV at the PC? I don't know. But this was well done. The footage on Balor and his journey, you know, from NXT to the main roster back to NXT. Again, well done. But there's not much else to say about it. It really wasn't much of a show. It was almost like a countdown type of show. And they were taping material today, as we speak, as I'm recording this. They are supposed to be taping material for NXT this week and possibly next week. Now, what does that mean when I say material? I don't know. Does that mean more video packages? Are they taping any actual matches? I have no indication of that. I'm going to save the RSPW rewind for next week, since we've gone the distance here. This is pretty good. I was a little worried about how long we'd get out of it this week, but there was a lot to get into. And so I'm going to save the rewind for next week. It's a good one, too. It's a good one. So we'll do that on episode 645. Let me, instead, before we end here, just take a couple of quick questions. You could always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I'm going to try to spend some time this afternoon responding back to people or pulling questions, either for next week's mailbag or the next video mailbag. I do have that on my list of things to do. To do more of the video mailbags on the YouTube channel. And so, if your question is not read here and I don't respond to you directly, you never know. It could end up on the list for the next video Q&A. So keep sending those questions. And let's see here. We got an interesting email I received from Parm titled NXT Data Analyst. It says, my internship at, and I'm going to withhold the name of the company he works for, although it's a company everybody's heard of, is going to end in August sometime. So I was exploring some other opportunities available, and look at what I found. I wonder why they are building a data analyst team for NXT. And he included a job posting for WWE for a summer internship as a data analyst, let me say that again, because it's easy for me to say, a data analytics intern, there we go, providing competitive analysis for NXT. Competitive analysis. Looks like they may be taking this AEW threat a little more seriously than they let on. So thank you to Parm for sharing that. Scotty from Ohio had a very interesting idea. He says, with this WrestleMania taking place with no fans in attendance, WWE really could do some unique things. They could shoot every match like the Final Deletion. However, the biggest thing I think they could do would be to give us Sting versus The Undertaker. You could shoot it in several takes and splice it all together, so if either guy needs a few water breaks, they could stop whenever they wanted. They could also possibly pad some of the bumps with a crash pad or something if they were sneaky enough to shoot it so that it wasn't in camera view. This would be the best way to get a good match out of these two. Now, that's not going to happen, and Undertaker already has a match with AJ Styles, but I was thinking about that, and I said to myself, you know, if they really ever did want to do a match like Sting against The Undertaker, and Sting may not even be cleared to do that, But if they wanted the safest way to do a match between these two that would take care of both guys and that they can edit and shoot in such a way to make them look as good as they can possibly look, why not? Why not shoot something between Sting and The Undertaker, not in the form of a traditional match? It would not be just a traditional wrestling match. You can't do that with those two. But what if it was something in the vein of a Final Deletion? Or a Boiler Room Brawl type of... I'm not saying do it in a boiler room, but you can shoot it at a location that's kind of dark and creepy. You got two dark, creepy characters. It would almost be like something out of a movie. It would be very Lucha Underground-esque. But it would be Sting against The Undertaker. If people want to see it so badly, if it's all about the characters and not so much the match itself. Hey, look, the longer this goes on for, if they want to really get creative, maybe. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is their chance to do something like that. I just thought it was an interesting... I don't believe there's any realistic chance of it happening. But I was thinking about Scotty's idea, and I said, you know what? He's not wrong. If ever there was a time to give something like that a shot, this could be it. And Derek from Kansas City, do you remember the Anatomy of a Match segments from the old Edge and Christian podcast? They did a few of them. One with Shawn Michaels and Mick Foley on their Mind Games match in 96, and another with Bret Hart and Steve Austin about their WrestleMania 13 match. Did you ever listen to them, and if so, what did you think? I think I may have listened to the Shawn and Mick one. I remember them talking about intentionally botching a move. And Foley may have mentioned this in his book too, but I remember them talking about intentionally botching a move during their match because Shawn Michaels at the time had a reputation for being a dick. He had a reputation for yelling like a child at his opponents in the middle of the match if they ever botched a move. He did it with Vader at SummerSlam in 96. Vader's laying there. Shawn jumps off the top rope. Vader's supposed to move. He doesn't move. Shawn stomps very hard on his head and yells, "Move!" One of many times he pulled that shit. So Mick's idea was, why don't we intentionally botch a move? And we'll have Shawn, you go ahead and yell at me. I don't know what purpose that served. I guess just to amuse themselves. But I do remember them talking about that. I thought it was a cool concept, the whole segment on their show. You know, it was even cooler. It was even cooler when I did it before they did here on this podcast. Not a lot of people, if you're a newer listener, you may not even be aware of this. I laughed out loud when I found out that Edge and Christian were calling their segment Anatomy of a Match, just because I literally had a segment on the Sound Off that started in 2011 called Match Anatomy. Like, not just the concept of the segment, but right down to the name. It was just comical to me that they came up with the same segment. Now, of course, I didn't have the benefit of having two wrestlers themselves talking about their match, and I'm not a wrestler, so I can't replicate that, right? This when I did it, it was obviously from a fan's perspective. But yeah, for those who don't know, I did Match Anatomy here on the Sound Off long before Edge and Christian ever did on their podcast. And if you ever want to go back in the archives and listen to all of the Match Anatomy segments, I only did, maybe half a dozen or more. But if you ever want to listen to them, the first one that I ever did was covering the Goldberg-Raven match. I did an analysis of the Goldberg-Raven match for the U.S. title on WCW Monday Nitro in 98. That was on Sound Off 191. All of these episodes are available on Podbean and iTunes and all that in the archives. And if maybe the iTunes doesn't go back that far, but Podbean does. And in fact, Podbean has all of the... They're organized on the sidebar by month, going all the way back, I think, to 2009. So not all of the shows are there, because I started the show in 2007. But that's if you want to go to a specific month. And again, I started this segment in March. What month was it? It was sometime in 2011. You can go back and find it there. So that was the first one I ever did, Sound Off 191. I did a Match Anatomy on the Kennel from Hell with Al Snow and Big Boss Man at Unforgiven 99. That was episode 195. Of course, I had to do one on the 1992 Royal Rumble. I did one on the entire pay-per-view. That was episode 202. I did one for Brock Lesnar against John Cena at Backlash 2003. So that was episode 214. I did one on the 1995 Royal Rumble match. That was episode 244. I did one on the Antonio Cesaro William Regal match in NXT from December 25th, 2013. Christmas Day. That was episode 307. I didn't do another one until episode 409. That was the Brock Lesnar Eddie Guerrero match in No Way Out 2004. I did one on the Hearts against Shawn Michaels and the Knights at Survivor Series 93. That was episode 412. I did one on Sting against Abyss for the NWA title at TNA Genesis in 2006. That was episode 413. My favorite one, and the last one I ever did, was episode 416 of The Sound Off. A special episode because DDP joined me. I had Diamond Dallas Page for the first time on the show. Sick as a dog, but he came on anyway. And I had him come on because at the time I was doing a countdown of the top 15 matches in WCW history. And one of the matches on my list was the match that DDP had with Bill Goldberg at Halloween Havoc in 98, which was one of Goldberg's greatest matches. So I had DDP himself, one of the participants in that match, come on the show and do a breakdown of the entire match, leading up to the match itself, coming out of the match. And he was great. It was very cool to hear his perspective on certain spots and why they did this and why they did that. So if you ever want to go back and listen to that, again, he sounds pretty rough at the very beginning, but his voice actually improves as the show goes on. That's episode 416. That was the last one I ever did. And I'm not opposed to doing more Match Anatomies. In fact, we may have to start doing more Match Anatomies, depending on how things are going to play out here these next few months. But for those who don't know, those are the episode numbers. So if you're looking for some time to kill, you can go back and download each of those episodes, and you can listen to those Match Anatomy segments. Keep emailing me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solomonster. Sub to the YouTube channel. We just broke 56K on our March 260. So if you haven't subbed already, please subscribe there. By the way, you would never know this, but in the middle of recording this podcast today, my computer shut down. I got a blue screen of death about 20 minutes ago in the middle of recording this show. My heart sank in my chest. Thankfully, I didn't lose much. I had just saved because my computer has been doing this a lot over the last week. And that's scaring the hell out of me. I don't know why all of us... It'll just randomly shut down or it'll freeze. And I have no idea why. And that worries me because now when I go live and I stream on YouTube, what the hell happens if I'm in the middle of streaming? And this thing shuts down on me. What happens to the stream? I don't even know if it gets archived. If it just gets abruptly cut off like that. So I'm very worried now. And hopefully that does not happen, but just FYI, in case I am ever streaming and all of a sudden the stream goes dead, you'll know why. Hopefully that won't happen. But this week coming up on Tuesday, that is every podcaster's worst nightmare, though. You're in the middle of recording, you don't know the last time you've saved, and all of a sudden there's a blue screen of death. I think it said critical process died. That was the error message I got. Of course, it doesn't tell you what the process was. Doesn't tell you why it happened, just that the critical process died. That's always encouraging. Dark Side of the Ring is premiering on Tuesday, part two. I guess I'm looking forward to it, but I know I'm going to be depressed as all hell. I will have a full review of that on the show next week. And before I go, this week is a bit of a rough week for me. It has been 5 years, 5 years Tuesday, since I lost my father. I'm grateful for the friendship that I have with Noah Mark and Brian Blade and Webmaster Mike, who were there for me in Santa Clara when I came out for WrestleMania the week after that and kind of helped take my mind off of things. And it's also 2 years on Thursday this week since I lost my mother. So not the same year, but I lost them both in the same week. And there is not a day that goes by that I do not think about her, and I'm so grateful that I was able to get her book published last summer, and I thank each and every one of you who have bought a copy on Amazon or wherever you may have bought it, shared pictures with me, a lot of you tried to get it and did get it into your local library, some of you got it into your school library and sent me pictures of it sitting on the rack in there. I love seeing that. And it means the world to me, and I know it would have meant the world to her too. And I miss them both, especially now with all that's been going on. You know, it feels a little more lonely around here. So take care of your parents if they're still around, and make sure they stay safe through all of this and that you do too. I will see you Wednesday night live on YouTube and next Sunday for episode 645. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Hello.
This is Morrison versus Adam Cole, Morrison versus Finn Balor, Morrison versus Tommaso Ciampa, Morrison versus Keith.
Let me ask you a question. Were you drinking during the pay-per-view tonight?
I was.
Okay, I thought so. Okay.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.